Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for another of our 2016 wrap-up shows. This is our annual podcast on the best horror films of the most recent year. So as is tradition here at F This Movie, I am joined for our favorite horror of 2016 podcast by everyone's favorite recurring guest host, the horror chick herself, Heather Wixon. How are you, Heather?
I'm great. You forgot top critic. I'm really disappointed.
I was waiting until that conversation came up. It will come up later on the show. But yes, we're joined by top critic, managing editor at DailyDead.com, Heather Wixon. How are you, Heather?
I'm great. Yeah, I realize it's been like 6 months since last time we did this. So thanks for being way too cool to talk to me this year, Patrick.
It has been my pleasure.
Excellent.
To be way too cool to talk to you. Some people are busier than others. Some people are trying to put out this dumb weekly podcast. Other people are writing books and have every hour dedicated to interviewing, transcribing, interviewing, writing. And so I think the people that are writing the books are maybe the ones who are too cool to talk to.
Oh, no, just too busy, I think, is probably the word. There's honest to God, this is the game I play that some days I'm like, what day was the last day I showered? And I don't mean to be terribly gross, but there's just certain weeks where I don't leave my house for 4 or 5 days. And I'll be like, when did I shower? Because that literally, I open my computer when I get up with my morning cup of coffee, and it goes, I close it up at about 3 a.m. every night, unless I'm up a little bit later. It's been kind of a crazy year, but an awesome year.
Super exciting, though. Do you want to talk about your book?
Yeah. I don't think I actually was able to really talk about much last time I was on because I hadn't really revealed anything
yet.
What I'm working on is basically chronicling the I can talk about this, too, is that, in fact, it's going to be two books now.
What?
Yes. So when I started this, what I wanted to do with this was I wanted to profile 20 special effects artists, just because over the years, you know, one of the things that I've always carried with me since high school is something that one of my teachers said to me was that everybody has a story. And I really believe that. I think everybody does have a story. And, you know, over the years, you see these really amazing books come out that either profile monsters themselves or talk to you about like how to make those monsters. And that's amazing. And those are really great resources and really cool things to have. But I realized for as much as we had those things, what we didn't really have was basically something that sort of took a little capsule of this part of history in cinema and really put the spotlight like on the folks behind that stuff. It seemed to me kind of the right fit. A few years ago, I'd done Stan Winston Week over on Daily Dead and got to hear some really amazing stories beyond just making the movies themselves. And it just kind of dawned on me, like, a lot of these people, they don't really get asked much about themselves other than, well, how did you do this? Well, what was the process of this? Well, how was it working with this person? And for me, that's great. But I wanted to kind of, you know, everybody has a different story. And that's the thing that I've realized now that I've done, I think, 36 interviews so far. And no two stories are the same, you know, and that's really cool. And I think it's a testament to sort of following your dreams and being creative. And yeah, so the first one, my first manuscript is due the end of February. So I am in the middle of a major hustle to try to meet that deadline. But it's really fantastic. And then the second book I'm going to start diving into probably in May. And I'm hoping, if all goes well, it might be out by the end of the year if I'm super ambitious and keep my shit together. But if not, it'll be out like early next year.
If you have a manuscript due at the end of February, why are you wasting your time on this podcast?
Because, it's you, Patrick. How can I say no?
I appreciate it. I just feel like, you know, you need to prioritize here. No, I'm just kidding. And the book, tell everyone what it's called.
Monster Squad.
Nice.
For me, it was, well, one, Lionsgate didn't exactly keep the copyright on Monster Squad for some stupid reason. Hopefully they're not listening to this and snagging up the rights right now. It was one of those things where I had to figure out a term or something that endeared all of these people to sort of what they would become like for modern horror. And one of those movies that for me I think it was one of the reasons I started to go back and watch Universal Monster movies again. Like, I saw a lot as a kid, but they go over your head when you're, like, a little kid. But when I saw Monster Squad, I was like, ooh, holy shit, this is really cool. And then I started to go back and really watch those movies. And that's, like, when I discovered, like, Son of Frankenstein and stuff like that. And for me, that movie is the spirit that I was trying to capture with this, the new and the old, because that movie, you know, to me is sort of that perfect mesh where, you know, they couldn't use Universal classic monsters. So what did they do? They went out and did their own spin on these characters that we all know and love. And I just thought it was such a perfect celebration of that idea that I was like, you know, I'd really like to be able to call it this. So it is. And yeah, so it's Monster Squad, a celebration of, oh, Jesus, I have had like 5 hours of sleep, so forgive me. Celebration of the special effects artist behind cinema's most memorable creatures.
Very nice. And there is there's a Twitter page for the book. It's at Monster Squad FX. And all of you listening right now should follow it. Many of you probably already are, but I know Heather's been putting out like cool behind the scenes pictures regularly. And it's not just like, hey, the book is coming. There's cool content that's there. So that's at Monster Squad FX.
Yes, thank you. And again, it was one of those things where I was like, well, I could just spend, you know, the next few months like, hey, there's a book, hey, there's a book, hey, there's a book. But again, there's just so many really cool pictures and things out there now, you know, because of the internet, that I was just like, man, there's a lot of really cool stuff you could profile there. And it's been really fun. Like, I just started in October and I think we're over 800 followers already, which, you know, isn't, you know, huge numbers, but I'm really excited about it because it's a lot of interaction over there. And it's just nice to see that there's a lot of other fans of practical effects out there.
Absolutely. After publicizing it on this podcast, you're going to be up to like 811 followers.
I am excited.
I can guarantee you 11 followers. Maybe.
What do I get if I don't get 11 followers?
You get to come back on and promote your book. Yeah, basically. Well, obviously you're going to be doing that anyway. I'm very excited for you. I can't wait to read it. I think it's awesome that that you are writing a book and that your talents are expanding even further than they already are beyond the pages of the internet and into the printed form. Is a gift to all of us, so I can't wait to read it.
Oh, thank you. But, now I have a lot to live up to.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. But I do too, because I promised. I have a lot to live up to too. I just promised you 11 followers.
All right, well, let's see.
Let's talk about our favorite horror movies of 2016. This has been a show that we've done the last few years, and it's always really fun to do. The week prior to this, I always do, you know, just the regular, like, top 10, here are my favorite movies that came out. And there was some debate on that episode because I do kind of compartmentalize, not because I don't think a horror movie could be on my regular top 10, but because I know that I'm doing two separate shows, I compartmentalize them on purpose because I would rather talk about 20 movies than the same 10 movies twice
over and over again.
Right.
Ah, I
so
get it.
And I did put some kind of I believe what you would call fringy horror movies on my regular top 10. So like Green Room was on there and The Love Witch was on there and something else that might be fringy. I've already forgotten my top 10. But so
they
tonight,
were just that top tier.
They were just that top tier. So tonight we're going to be talking about just horror movies, and we were just talking before we started recording that I think this is the first year in a long time that both of us could have expanded the list, right? I know you were saying like this was the first year that you were able to put really just horror movies on your top 10 and not ones that kind of bleed into those other genres. For me, I honestly was back and forth. I was like, do I do a top 15? Well, that's not fair. I don't want to spring that on you. And then I was going to do a separate top five of just studio horror movies, because for the first time ever, I could do that.
Right.
And then do a top 10 like indie horror movies. And I thought, well, that's not really fair. So I punked out and I did do a tie for my number 10. But other than that, I just have some honorable mentions. It was difficult for me to leave two movies specifically off of my top 10.
I had to do a few Sophie's choices myself. Because like you said, there is a really, really solid year. And the fact that, you know, we could even talk about as many studio horror movies as we can this year that were good. you know, that were really solid. Whether or not you love them or you know, you sort of like them, they're solid movies. And that's, to me, was one of the biggest surprises. And I remember, and I think I even said this last year, like, you know, it was nice to kind of see studio horror starting to step up last year. But I think this year has been one of the, universally one of the best, like, studio horror years that we've had in a long time.
It was really strong. I liked, there were a few that I missed. Of the ones that I saw, I think I liked all but one of them, and we'll talk about maybe what that one is later, especially if it shows up on your list. But also, you know, we had been over the last week at DailyDead.com. You guys have been running our top 10 lists, and it's not just movies, because I know on your list you had some things included that were not movies. On my list, I had some things included that were not movies, because it was just an amazing year just to be a horror fan, whether it's the movies that came out. You had mentioned, you know, John Carpenter touring, playing live horror on TV between The Exorcist and The Walking Dead and Channel Zero. Ash versus Evil Dead had a
Stranger Things.
Yeah, like some really good horror TV shows. I went to see Fabio Frizzi play The Beyond Score live. You went to that too, didn't you?
I did not.
You did not. You hate things that are good. And there was some other stuff too. You know, just every, so many just Blu-ray releases that were incredible. Old crazy movies that you can't believe we now own in high def coming out on Blu-ray. Like, it is a great time to be a horror fan. Would you agree with that?
I would. You know, for as much as 2016 sucked in a lot of ways.
Almost all of the ways.
Almost all of the ways except horror.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the reason most of us were able to get through 2016, because at least we had a lot of nice diversions to kind of be like, yeah, this is all really a big pile of crap. But hey, I'm going to go see John Carpenter play and it's going to be okay for 2 hours.
It's going to be like the highlight of the year. It's going to be like one of the greatest things ever. Yes, absolutely. That you know, we... Those of us who are kind of way into horror obviously kind of immerse ourselves in the genre and in talking to other genre fans and stuff. So it is a very welcome distraction.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say for as much as like there was a lot of heartbreak and there's a lot of uncertainty going into this year, particularly on the political side, obviously after this week, you know.
With that, I couldn't hear you. I had pee on me.
Oh, sorry. Did I interrupt something? But yeah, I think like the fact that we were able to sort of unplug from all that just horribleness and find really great things to kind of put our energy into. I mean, I'm grateful for that. Like, this has been one of my very favorite years as a 2016 was one of my very favorite years as a journalist because, you know, it was literally like every month there was like a new gift for us to unwrap. And almost every single month there was something to look forward to, and it doesn't always happen that way.
Yeah.
It was honestly one of the busiest years I've ever had doing this. But I say that as a positive thing because I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. So with that being said, let us jump into our top 10. Now I did again rank mine.
I ranked mine too.
Good.
I decided to rank it this year and get in line. I don't want Sheriff Patrick to come down on me for going willy nilly.
A crazy person. The ranking is fairly arbitrary for me, as it often is. Like I feel strongly about my number one, and everything else is like I also really like this.
Yeah,
you know?
Everything else is number two.
Right, everything else could kind of shift around. But you are the guest. You are the one with a book coming out. I will let you go first with your number 10 pick.
I picked for number 10, Phantasm Ravager.
Ooh, very nice.
Here's the thing, and I know a lot of people have given this movie a lot of crap for its CG and blah, 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 but frankly, that's like the whole franchise, or at least some of the sequels. They all have crazy, weird CG. To me, that story, I mean, I cried at the end. It's a horror movie. You know what I mean? It's a Phantasm movie. You're not supposed to cry.
Right.
And there was something so satisfying about seeing those characters come together for the last time in that way. And it felt almost like Phantasm by way of Bubba Hotep in a way.
Absolutely.
You know, and it was made with such heart. And again, so a lot of people are like, well, you know, Coscarelli didn't seem that involved. And I couldn't disagree with that idea more, you know, and I like, you can see where Hartman kind of went out and made this his movie because he's such a fan. Obviously fan with a PH, but to see still all of those like touchstone things that we love about the Phantasm franchise, like on display here, I loved it. I really did. Like I had a big grin on my face and I, you know, when you were there when we saw the 4K trailer, where we were at the Phantasm screening at Flashback Weekend and we all saw the Ravager trailer and we all cringed.
Yeah.
And the trailer did nothing for it. And I was really kind of skeptical going into it. And I, you know, I hate saying that, but it's the truth. And I love being proved wrong. You know, I was proved wrong on The Exorcist and I was proved wrong on Phantasm Ravager. And I just, something so purely made doesn't happen very often. And there's nothing but pure, like, love and admiration for that franchise in that movie.
I agree completely. I the things that are wrong in that trailer, I think are still more or less wrong in the movie. If you're going to say it's wrong, it does look like and often feel like a fan film. Again, fan with a PH. In this case, I don't consider that a negative. I get that it's a movie with like a lot of rough edges. It doesn't have a ton of polish.
All of the Phantasm movies. They all
100%. 100%. I am not even, you know, I like the first Phantasm a lot. I'm a fairly casual fan of the series. I've seen all the movies a couple times, but that's not my franchise. You know, it's not even in my top three franchises, and that's okay. So seeing the film and being as moved by it as I was, I really felt like it was a testament to the filmmakers, because even as somebody who didn't need to be satisfied in terms of finding closure, in terms of feeling like, wow, they really wrapped this up nicely, I felt so good for the diehard fans, because I felt like, yeah, this movie really cares about them. And I think the movie bothered to say some things that were much bigger outside of the franchise that resonated with me, even as somebody who's more of a casual fan of the franchise. There was still a lot that I could take away from it beyond just the kind of standard fan service. Well, we have to tie this up and wrap this up and have this person make a cameo or whatever. You had mentioned Bubba Hotep, and I completely agree that it seems to have some of those same things on its mind. And yeah. It's one of those movies, and a handful of the movies on my list this is true of a handful of the movies on my list where it is not the slickest, most well-produced film of the year, but it makes up for that tenfold in heart, which you had mentioned, and that's really what I took away from the movie, is just how much heart it has. I've been trying to listen to a couple of popular horror podcasts lately to see what's out there, and one of the ones that I've been checking out, which I think is one of the bigger ones, recently did their top 10 show, and Phantasm Ravager I believe was named one of the worst and got multiple worst of the year votes, which just blew me away. I understand not every movie is for everyone, but just as a horror fan, I don't see how you could watch that movie and not feel how much...
Something.
Just how much love there is for that series, you know?
Yeah.
And to at least excuse it on that. It doesn't have to work for you. You don't have to say it's a great movie, but at least you could say, well, it's obvious that everyone really cared about this, and maybe set your sights on something just cynical and shitty as opposed to something like Phantasm Ravager. I get it. The world's a rainbow. It's fine. I was really surprised to hear people picking that as the worst horror movie of the year, because I could not disagree more.
Well, all I'm going to say is I think worst of lists are absolute shit.
I agree 100%.
And all I can say is I'm so glad that I don't have to deal with that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not productive. It's just people trying to seem smart and snarky for the sake of saying stuff to maybe win them, you know, cool points with their friends or whoever they're talking to. And it does nothing for me, and it does nothing for the genre.
And I say all the time that the movie that you say is the worst movie is somebody else's favorite movie.
Howling 2.
Exactly. And I And I, you know, I know that sometimes I could be a hypocrite because I do talk shit about movies. It's not like I'm just going to say like, well, every movie is good in its way. Because there are movies that I don't like that I will talk shit about. But I do that recognizing that I know that somebody else loves this. This works for somebody else, you know.
Yeah.
And so, oh, yeah, worst of list is really just, hey, you're wrong to like this. And I'm not super interested in doing that. But perhaps that segues nicely into my number 10, because it is a movie that also ended up on some worst of lists. So my number 10, I did punk out, and I have a tie because I didn't want to leave.
Weak.
I get it. But believe me, I came so close to doing like a top 12, a top 15, and all of those would have been unacceptable. So I just decided to make a tie here. So the first one did not end up on any worst of lists, and that is Shin Godzilla.
Okay.
The latest entry in the Godzilla series. Have you seen it?
I missed it this fall. It played like in LA like the one weekend. Like I think it was like right after I came back from Fantastic Fest or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was stupid sick and I didn't get to see it. And I missed it at Fantastic Fest. Because they didn't play. Oh, no, it was Beyond Fest or something. I missed it. I wanted to see it. I was actually hoping by now it would have had like its either home release or something. But I don't think it's made its way there yet. Says the girl who does Blu-ray and DVD reviews every week.
I think it's coming soon. I don't know.
I think it's in March, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. It's really good. It's certainly the best Godzilla movie in a long time. And really, I just wanted to include it on the list because it's exciting to have a cool Godzilla movie. And one that really gets back to, you know, personal taste. I tend to prefer the Godzilla movies where he's fighting another giant monster. I get that the original Godzilla is a classic, and I love how much it says about, you know, kind of the state of Japan at the time and kind of post-war fears and anxieties. All that stuff is super cool. In terms of entertainment, like, I would much rather watch Godzilla fight Rodan or something. And so this movie is much more in the vein of the original Godzilla in that, you know, he is the destructor. They redesign Godzilla. He's actually kind of scary. There's an insane amount of destruction on display. A really nice blend of what appears to be practical and CG, where you can't quite tell most of the time which is which I really like, because, again, we've seen a handful of CG Godzillas in recent years, and they don't all work. The first half hour is actually almost comedy. It's very kind of satirical, where it's cutting back and forth between this Godzilla monster destroying, laying waste to all of Japan, while people sit around a boardroom and try to figure out what they should do. And then it kind of gets away from some of the satire, and then, you know, really puts its faith in. I like kind of then where it goes and what it has to say in terms of, okay, we need to work together and figure out a solution. I mean, it's really entertaining, cool monster movie. Godzilla's cool again, and it was very satisfying as a fan of those movies.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I recommend that one a lot. The one that I tied it with, I couldn't imagine not putting on my top 10, which is insane because, like I said, this is a movie that ended up on a lot of worst of lists, came out last January. People shit all over it, perhaps rightfully so. I've watched it a couple of times since then, and I was looking at what I had seen this year, and I was like, you know what? This is a movie I'm going to go back to more than a lot of these other movies. So how can I not put it on my top 10? And that is The Boy.
Interesting. Okay.
I can't totally defend it, but that movie just works for me.
No, it's, you know what? It's really funny because I've been, The Boy and The Gift are two of like sort of my blind spots over the last like 2 years that I really have been wanting to get to, but I kind of always forget about. But the fact that I've heard that like The Boy kind of has this crazy sort of weird twist third act thing, like that intrigues me. Like everything else, I'm kind of like, eh. But when it, like, I hear that it kind of goes a little nuts, like that to me, I'm like, okay, sign me up. I missed it. I don't know how or why. I think it might have been, I might have been, because it came out maybe like when I was at Sundance last year.
Yeah, probably.
And I just never got sent a screener for it. So I was a little bummed.
And honestly, you know, it seems like the kind of movie that you could miss. It's the studio horror movie in January. It was last year's Bye Bye Man. You know, it was like, whatever. If I don't see the boy, it's fine. And the reviews were not great. And I skipped it in theaters. And then when it finally came to, like, iTunes or Redbox or something, I thought, well, I want to give this a chance because, like you, I had heard about the twist. And thought it was okay to decent. And then it was really cheap on iTunes 1 week. It was, like, $5 or $7 or something. So I bought it because I wanted to rewatch it. And I've watched it a couple times since then. And honestly, the thing that keeps bringing me back to it is, one, I love the cinematography. I think it's really beautiful. And two, is Lauren Cohen's performance. And we had talked about this because I think I brought this movie up on our underrated show a couple weeks ago. This was one of my picks. I just think Lauren Cohen is so good in the movie and creates such a believable person and a believable response to the situation that she is in that she really carries me through the movie. And then, yeah, I do love kind of the wacky thing that happens, which I don't want to talk about, but it makes it fun instead of just dumb. Like it's still kind of dumb, but in a really fun way. And like I said, I can't totally defend it, but it's just a horror movie that I know that I'm going to revisit. And if I'm being honest with myself, I have to include it in my top 10.
Excellent. Yeah. To be honest, there was one that I only just watched, cause I saw it was on cable and I was like, you know, I'm going to DVR this. That came really close to making my list. And maybe I should have cheated and done like a number 10 part two, but Amelie, like that movie surprised the hell out of me.
Oh, Emily?
Yeah, Emelie.
Amelie, I'm like the one with Audrey Tautou, like putting the trolls on people's lawns. Yeah, I saw Emelie.
It's got like the weird accent on it. So I never know if it's like a thing, but yeah, like, I'm always a fan of like weird, crazy babysitter stuff because, you know, I used to babysit and used to be babysitted a lot. So that was always one of my big fears is like, well, if my mom's not here and, you know, something happens, it's their word against mine and I'm the kid. So I'm screwed. But I was really surprised by that movie. And it went completely off my radar because was that like an IFC movie or something like that?
I think so.
It was one of those where it kind of did the VOD run.
Yeah,
maybe
that's
had like a limited theatrical.
That's how I saw it. It showed up on iTunes and I watched it that way.
Yeah, and I was really surprised by it. Like the scene with the snake was, honest to God, one of the most unsettling things I've watched all year. So I guess if I was going to cheat and have a number 10 part two, that'd be that. But no, I think it's good. Again, it's one of those years where you can even make cases for movies that are just good. They're not super amazing, like movies we're going to be talking about in 30 years, but they're good.
Right.
You know?
But I guess the crime, if there's a crime, is, you know, we have to be able to differentiate between like objectively good and subjective taste, right? And all we can talk about is subjective taste because there are movies that I could put The Boy up against and objectively say, this is a better made movie. Movies that did not make my list. Other studio horror films that did not make my list. I think if I'm trying to be completely objective, they are better than The Boy. And yet, I would rather rewatch The Boy than some of these other movies. So, Emily is... every year I do this list of like favorite moments in movies over the course of the year. And the snake scene made my list. But it was a real toss-up between that and the weird scene where she's like asking for a tampon. She's like sitting on a toilet asking a child to get her a tampon. And I'm like, this movie is willing to cross lines. And I admire that. Honestly,
there's
the thing,
a ballsiness to that movie that I wasn't expecting.
I felt like the third act just kind of petered out a little bit. I wanted it to, because when you have that shit going on in the middle of your movie, I feel like your third act really needs to go nuts. And it doesn't really. And so I feel like if the third act had found a way to top sort of that line crossing or that craziness, I would really love that movie. Instead, I think it's good. I like it. But yeah, the third act for me didn't live up to the first two.
Yeah, it kind of needed to go Sleepaway Camp on you, and it just gets close, but it never quite crosses that line.
Right. All right, what is your number 9?
My number 9 is Hush.
Okay, that's a movie that I put in my honorable mentions, and it pains me to not put it in my top 10.
I mean, and realistically, like, talking about, like, I could have put Ouija Origin of Evil in there. And
both of those are in my... I was killing myself. I literally rewatched Ouija 2. I texted you. Like, I'm rewatching stuff, trying to cram last minute, because I rewatched Ouija 2 today, trying to decide, like, this really does belong in my top 10, but there's just no space for it. Same with Hush. I think both of those are so good.
Yeah, I mean, what a testament to Mike Flanagan. I mean, I didn't love Oculus, but I appreciated
it's like three quarters. Yeah, I think it's like three quarters
of a really,
really good
solid
movie.
Yes, yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, and you know, so for me, like, I was like, okay, I didn't love Oculus, but I'm still willing to see what he's got. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And he just I can't even describe like how he can get us to care about characters that on paper maybe we shouldn't. You know what I mean? Like, it's Ouija. It's a sequel to Ouija, like a really ridiculously dumb teen movie. You know, by all accounts, like, we should be able to write that sequel off and move on as horror fans. You know, if we're being snobs and elitists about it, which oftentimes, you know, admittedly we can be.
If it hadn't have been Mike Flanagan, I probably would have, you know, I
exactly.
probably would have said like, yeah, no thanks, but no thanks. But the fact that he's doing it makes you consider it.
Yeah. And the fact that to make such a bare bones home invasion movie and make it feel like it's not the same home invasion movie we've watched 100 times over and over again.
Right.
Is astounding. And the fact that he could get us to care. I mean, and it's funny because there's actually more supernatural stuff on my list, but I'm not even a huge fan of supernatural horror. I'm really not. Ghosts and that kind of stuff do nothing for me. I'm just kind of like, all right. Yet there's three movies on my list that kind of fit into that realm. Go figure. But the way that, like, he got us to really fall in love with that family in like the first 10 minutes, like, I mean, it's so rare. And to have that in a studio movie above all else, like, is even more amazing. And the fact that even Platinum Dunes is attached to that
right.
is even more mind blowing. Like, that's amazing. And the fact that, you know, you could tell Mike really fought for it because there's such a Mike Flanagan feel to it. You know, we're gonna trademark that. But, like, there's such a Flanagan feel to it. Like, you're watching it and you know that you're immediately in this world.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the technique in Ouija 2, I think, is really strong. I think, and we'll come back to Hush, obviously, but I think Hush is probably a better technical movie. And is almost purely a technical movie. Ouija, you know, the supernatural stuff that you're talking about is actually most of my least favorite stuff in the movie. There's a couple of cool images, but all the stuff that they put in the marketing with the girl with her mouth wide open and the white eyes, yeah. like, that's actually my least favorite stuff in the movie.
Mine too.
Part of me wishes that it had just come out with a different name, not as a sequel to Ouija, because I think people would have given it more of a chance. All the stuff that I love about the movie, like you said, is caring about the characters. There's a moment where the red-haired girl, the daughter, the older daughter, who I think was the girl from Oculus.
She was.
Has what may be her first kiss with a boy, and it's just an insanely great cinematic moment. Watching it again today. Oh, by the way, Henry Thomas, it gives one of my favorite performances of the year in that movie. I think he's so good in that movie. And it's unfortunate, again, that the last act, I think, sells a lot of these characters short. Again, for me, some people have no problem with it. Maybe it's really great. Maybe I need to see it again. But I remember feeling like, oh, this didn't land where I wanted it to. But I feel like the stuff that works in that movie is some of the best Spielbergian filmmaking that isn't just explicitly Spielbergian, right? We throw that word around a lot because there are filmmakers, you know, J.J. Abrams, obviously most notoriously in Super 8, is making a Spielberg fan film, right? And doing everything he can to evoke that Spielbergian feel. And I don't feel like Mike Flanagan is doing that, and yet there's so much in Ouija 2 that I feel could have come right out of, like, 1981 Spielberg. And I think it's really, really good.
Yeah, no, it's been a really cool year for him. I'll be curious to see one if Before I Wake ever comes out and to see how people react to it. Because I don't think it's nearly as polished. Like, now that versus what I've seen with these two movies, I don't think it's nearly as polished as those two. But he just has a way of sort of weaving in this heart into his stories where you're not expecting it.
Right.
That, I mean, you know, like I said, to be sitting here talking about either like a home invasion movie or the sequel to Ouija, like blows my mind. Like what it's we're in a weird little wormhole now.
Well, so but let's talk about Hush, because that's the movie that's actually on your list.
Yeah, no, I just thought one, you know, there was a lot of hubbub this year in terms of representation in cinema. And I do agree it's an issue that needs to be addressed. But I don't think it needs to be addressed in the way that people sort of were addressing it this year. And I know there was a lot of issues with the actress in Hush not actually being deaf. Same as they were kind of upset with Stephen Lang for not being blind in Don't Breathe. Yet people don't understand, I guess, how movies are made sometimes, and that those kind of things end up with bigger, like, insurance waivers and stuff like that. And it's a much different environment. Not to say that those folks shouldn't be incorporated, but this was a role that she wrote for herself. I think it's Kate Davies. Am I right?
It is Kate Siegel.
Siegel, that's who it is. Okay.
And now married to Mike Flanagan, yes?
Yes, yes. I think they got married after Oculus because I believe she was in that too. But it was a movie that she wrote specifically for herself because she knew that she could handle that role. And she trained herself and she did everything. And so I felt it was a little unfair to call her out on that when that movie came out because I saw a little like hubbub online. And I'm like, but she wrote it for herself. And I think she did a brilliant job of really finding the strengths of that movie in that it's the silence that really gets you in that movie because it's so unnerving at times. Like there's moments where that movie, like the sound just shuts off. And me, I'm a person at home where like if it gets too quiet, I have to put on the TV or put on the radio. Silence drives me nuts. And I think for me, that's why that movie works so well, because there's moments where it's almost like the silence is like screaming in your ears and you just want to hear something. And it really puts you in this woman's world. And you're right in the center of this chaotic like situation of this crazy guy standing outside your door mocking you. And to me, like it felt so very relatable in a way that like, I don't know what any of us would do if some weirdo just ended up showing up on your door for no reason.
Right.
You know, so the strangers because you were home, you know, and there it is. And I really appreciated that how there was no frills to that movie. It knew exactly what it wanted to be. It got in there. It got the job done. And again, it was like, I remember watching, because I watched it as a screener before South By, and I was like, okay, we'll see how it goes. And I was really blown away. Like when it was over, I was like, man, that was really fun. And it's to have Mike to be able to do two very different movies in the same year. I mean, that's really cool. Not a lot of directors can pull that off.
It's pretty exciting to be able to kind of watch, you know, it's watching, James Wan maybe 2 or 3 years ago after kind of the 1-2 of Insidious and The Conjuring, where he's kind of working at two different ends. I mean, they're similar in a lot of ways, but their scares kind of come from different places, and you're watching somebody and you're like, oh, this guy is becoming one of the major voices in the genre. And I feel like this was that year for Mike Flanagan. You know, Hush is such, like I said, kind of a technical exercise in terms of creating suspense, creating tension, relieving tension, geography of where are we in this single location. Like you said, doing stuff with sound, what we hear, what we don't hear. And yet, as you had said in reference to Ouija 2, like still gives you so much to care about, because I watched it, I want to say, I know it had played at a couple festivals and then it showed up on Netflix. And so I watched it the night it debuted on Netflix, and I literally knew nothing about it. I knew that it was called Hush, and I knew that it was the new movie from the guy who made Oculus. And I said, all right, I'm in. And I pressed play, and the movie starts, and we've already talked about it, so it's not really a spoiler, but it is about a deaf woman who is being stalked by this guy outside her house. I didn't even know that much watching the movie, and it doesn't actually reveal that for the first few minutes. She's by herself. She's making dinner. There's no indication that she's deaf because she's not talking to anyone. You know, there's no reason for us to think that. So even that played like a reveal to me. And by the time that reveal came, part of it is just, you know, the way those first few minutes are written. So much of the credit, I think, goes to Kate Siegel, who gave, I thought, one of my favorite performances in a genre movie this year, and is somebody who, like, if I find out she's in anything now, I'm absolutely going to make it a point to see it. She's so good in that role that by the time just the death reveal came, much less by the time the guy shows up on the porch, I was like, I'm in. Whatever happens to this woman, I'm in, because I want to see her survive. I care about her. And so it becomes much more than just a technical exercise, right? That, because there was another movie that came out this year that, again, a lot of people like, and I won't mention it now because maybe it shows up on your list. Very much a technical exercise, very much about, like, boo. And I just never found myself caring about the people in that story. And so I never could get invested. And I feel like what Mike Flanagan understands is, as long as you care about the people, the scares will play better.
Intriguing. Now I'm curious about what movie that might be.
Well, if it's not on your list, remind me and I'll tell you. But I don't want to shit on something if it shows up further on down your list.
Gotcha. But yeah, no, it's a it was a very good year for Mike. And I'm really excited to kind of see what he gets to do with Gerald's Game. I think that's going to be a very interesting project.
I'm excited. I'm excited to see whatever he does next. My number nine is a movie that you saw at a festival and then were warning me, like, I think you saw it at Sundance and then you were trying to figure out if I should see it or not because you weren't sure if I was going to like it or hate it. And that is Trash Fire.
Okay. Yes.
By Ricky Bates Jr. Again, not 100% a horror film. Takes a really long time, actually, to become a horror film. And I've liked both of his first two movies in varying degrees. I liked how kind of outrageous the things he did in Excision were. And again, talk about a movie that is willing to cross certain lines, the way we talked about with Emily.
Oh, he threw those lines right out the window. Yeah, loved right. it. Loved it.
I thought Suburban Gothic was fun, but certainly much more of just kind of a comedy with some supernatural elements. But I thought fun and had a kind of a cool tone. And I feel like Trash Fire is both of those movies smashed together, where for the first half of the movie, we're in Suburban Gothic with these characters who are kind of sarcastic and talking shit at one another. And there's kind of a misanthropic, dark sense of humor about it. And then at a certain point, we find ourselves in Excision, and it's like, oh, now things are really fucked up. And the final reel of that movie, not that they shoot movies in reels anymore, but the last, you know, 15 minutes of that movie are very disturbing and feature one of the scarier characters in a movie this year. It was just a movie that, like, I never knew where it was going. I never really knew how to feel about it. And it played at the Chicago Critics Festival, and it was a late night screening, and I was, I think, maybe the only critic who kind of stuck around, because I think it had already shown once, so everybody else had already seen it. So they asked me, we collect these ballots afterwards, people just tear a number 1 through 5, and then there's an audience award at the end of it. So they said, hey, would you mind collecting ballots for Trash Fire? And it was very interesting to see the ballots come in, because the reactions were very polarized. It was either, hey, I really liked this and this was on my wavelength, or I remember having one guy say, like, oh, you don't even want me to turn one in. You don't want to know what I have to say, and just angrily walk past me. And I was like, well, I can't blame you. Like, this is a movie that inspires those two reactions. And I like a movie where there isn't really any room for middle ground. It's like, hey, you're either with me or you are going to fucking hate this. And I admire, you know, that he's willing to make that kind of a movie. Part of me wishes that, because the first half is this really dark shit about this couple that kind of hates each other, and Adrian Grenier playing this selfish prick. And in the second half of the movie, almost all that stuff goes out the window. It's kind of forgotten that it's about this selfish prick. He just becomes kind of a normal guy, and the squabbling kind of stops. And so the second half forgets some of what came before it, but I still feel like where it goes was interesting enough that I was able to forgive it.
Yeah. No, I very much enjoyed Trash Fire. I still think I liked Excision much better.
Sure.
Just because it pretty much committed itself very early on to the level of crazy that it wanted to go.
Absolutely.
And it just kept going there. And that finale still, I still can feel it in my gut, that finale, and that look on Tracy Lord's face. I liked Trash Fire a lot.
Yeah.
I think I would have liked it more if we would have gotten more of like Anna Lynn.
Right.
Because she's so fucking good in it. But my if I had a quibble with that movie, and maybe it's the reason it didn't make my top 10, is I just absolutely hate Adrian Grenier. Whatever the hell his name is.
Yeah, I don't either, and you are not wrong. But again, I feel like this is cast in that.
Oh, yeah, because I look at his face and I just want to punch him.
It plays to our hatred of him, I think.
Yeah, because and I'll tell you what's funny is he actually tried to have us kicked out of a bungalow at Sundance years ago. So maybe I harbor some ill will because he tried to have myself and Tyler Labine and Alec Tudyk kicked out of a bungalow because he was hanging out for something they were doing for Entourage as we were doing interviews for Tucker and Dale.
Ugh.
And we were and our interview upstairs was bothering him downstairs. And by the way, he was just sitting there. He wasn't doing press. And I think maybe that just stuck with me. So I was like, oh, you smug son of a bitch. You know, so I think that really like hit me. But I just I literally was like, I just really want this character to go away. Like I and it's good. I mean, that means that Ricky wrote a really fantastic character that you just really dig into. Like the problem wasn't that I didn't dig into him because there's a lot to dig in. I just felt like what we get in that third act, I would have liked a little more of that in the second.
Sure.
You know, to balance. But yeah. I still think it's a hell of a movie. It's definitely one of the more memorable movies I saw all last year. Like I still think about it. But yeah, it's just because of stupid Adrian Grenier's whatever the hell his name is. That's going to be my new thing is I don't know how to say his last name. Grenadine? I don't know. I swear I'm not drunk. But yeah, so, you know, just because I literally hate him, that it was just really hard for me to want anything good for him in this movie. So that's probably the only reason. But no, it's an amazing, amazing movie. And I love when directors don't shy away from uncomfortable stuff. And there's a lot of very uncomfortable things that come up in that movie very quickly. Like in the first 5 minutes, you're whoa, shit. You're like, okay. And I love directors who do that. I like directors who know how to push buttons. And I think we need more of those.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, that was one I actually sort of tussled with a little bit in terms of not putting it on my list. So, yeah, it was I think I will watch anything he does. I really will. Like between this and between Excision and Suburban Gothic and Trash Fire, I think he's done an amazing job as like establishing his voice in the genre. And I'm on for whatever else he wants to do.
Yeah. Well said. Your number eight.
My number eight. It's sort of a movie that I championed over on my favorites list because I kind of wanted sort of a movie that I don't feel like a lot of folks sort of paid attention to last year. Cause again, it was one of those that sort of kind of came and went on VOD. And it's Baskin.
Okay.
Because it is, again, I like movies that sort of become part of my DNA, like movies that you just spend a lot of time thinking about. And I mean, I saw that movie during the summer and I've probably thought about it once a day in some way, shape or form. I don't know why. I don't know if it was just the right day at the right time, but man, like I was ready to go on that trip and you know, you're in for bad stuff, but nothing prepares you once you get there. And I like that. Like for me, it just felt like Fulci by way of Clive Barker in a way. And it's funny cause like I saw, at Fantastic Fest, last year, I had a chance to see We Are the Flesh. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
I haven't yet. I'm eagerly awaiting. I know.
No, I mean, maybe you are. I don't know. That movie to me just turned me off in every possible way.
Okay.
Because I was actually kind of looking for something a little more Baskin-y. And what I mean by that is just that I love this idea of sort of, there's a lot I can't say because it sort of ruins that payoff at the end for anybody who goes to find it. I think it's on like Netflix Instant and stuff now.
It is, yeah.
But it's a finale you're either on board with or you call bullshit on. And you have to be in that moment to know whether or not you're willing to take that leap. And I was. And I get why some people weren't. Like, it, you know, that doesn't bother me. But I was very surprised by it. And again, it's one of those movies that, like, I just remember, like, sitting, like, watching We Are the Flesh. And it's not any fair to We Are the Flesh because, you know, it's its own thing. And boy, is it. But I just kept the whole time listening, like, God, why can't you just be, like, Baskin? Like, yeah, I will be very curious to hear what you think about We Are the Flesh. But, one, I saw it at Fantastic Fest when their DCP file wasn't working. So we watched a ripped Blu-ray.
Oh.
And it was so pixelated that literally, because I had to sit in the front row, it was so pixelated, the pixels were almost the size of the plate that my mozzarella sticks came on, basket.
Right.
Yeah, it was huge pixels, really hard to see. I don't know that would have changed the experience, because you'll figure that out when you see it, but it is, it's kind of like if you've ever really wanted to watch, like, weird, surreal incest porn. That's the best way. Post-apocalyptic setting. That's about what you're going to get.
What do you think I've been doing while we're recording this podcast?
Between your golden showers? yeah, no, it's a movie for some people. It definitely was.
There's your
not
a
movie
quote.
For me. Yeah.
Top critics say it's a movie for some people.
Yeah, it was very uncomfortable for me. I don't disagree that it's a very provocative movie in terms of, like, the imagery that it uses, and that it's very vaginal in nature, I guess is the best way to put it.
Sure. So am I.
Aren't we all, though? That I got really close to almost appreciating, but then the rest of it, I was just like, ah, no. So, I mean, I'd like to watch it again, like, within the context of seeing it, like, how the director intended me to see it,
right,
like a big black box of pixels. But anyway, right. Baskin sort of filled that void of, like, that depraved, just waking nightmare of a movie that really, again, pushes boundaries and kind of makes you uncomfortable. So I think, yeah. So if I had a cinematic safe word this year, it was Baskin.
I like your description of Fulci by way of Clive Barker. It's interesting that you say you thought about it every day since, because I watched it, I think, when it first hit Netflix Instant, and forgot it until I saw it on your best of list at Daily Dead. And I was like, oh, yeah, right. That was a movie that I saw. And
it's a movie for somebody.
I was happy to hear you championing it, because I haven't heard a ton of people doing that. And so I was glad that you were kind of trying to turn people onto it. For me, it was one of those movies that, you know, the more horror movies I see, I think the better I've gotten at saying, like, okay, not all of it works, but this and this and this is really strong. And so I think it's worth seeing just for those things, or it makes me interested to see what this person is going to do next or whatever. So I didn't love the entirety of Baskin, but I will agree with you 100% that there are moments and images and a certain vibe, particularly in that last act, that I think absolutely makes it worth seeing, and that I think makes me happy that it's on your list. If nothing else, it's a Turkish horror film, and I have not seen very many Turkish horror films.
I believe it was probably my first.
Right.
I think actually when I was watching, I was like, I can't name another Turkish horror movie that I could have possibly seen. So it probably was my first.
Yeah. And there's some really, really great stuff in there. You know, it's one of these movies that I think, I don't want to say slow burn, because that has just become an overused term.
Is it torture porn?
It does take a while to kind of get to its payoff, even though there are, you know, things here and there that kind of will keep you invested or whatever. But, you know, part of it is, in going back to what we were talking about with Mike Flanagan, it presented me with a group of characters that was hard for me to invest in, somewhat by design. And so by the time the payoff came, I was like, well, this is super imaginative and very visually cool and showing me some truly just gnarly, nightmarish shit. But, you know, there's that separation of, like, yeah, but I'm noticing that instead of caring about anything that what's happening. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. I, of course, I would say like the character's name, but I honestly, after 5 hours of sleep, I can barely remember that I'm Heather and you're Patrick.
Right.
But the main guy that we follow, because we see like his sort of backstory and stuff like that. Like for me, being able to kind of see where it goes in the finale, and then sort of tying it all the way back to those hints that we get like in his like backstory. Like I just thought it was very, very smart. And it's one of those, like, when you see it the second time, you're like, oh, okay. Like, I was able to kind of put those dots together a little bit, because I actually watched it twice in a row just to...
Oh, wow.
Well, I had an online screener, which, you know, sometimes when movies are really dark, it's kind of hard to see stuff on your computer screen, you know?
Right.
So I wanted to make sure, like, okay, I really have that experience, plus it expired, like, the next day. So I was like, well, if I'm ever going to watch it for another time, you know, it's going to be now. But once I kind of got to go back and watch it again, like, in retrospect, a lot of those puzzle pieces kind of, especially, like, in the beginning as we're sort of settling in, really fit together a lot better for me. Just because I had perspective as to what it was leading up to.
Okay.
And could kind of connect some of those like visual dots that are put there. So, I get why, you know, there's a lot of people who didn't like it or whatever. I'm not going to begrudge anybody their opinion, but I do think if people give it a chance, it's one of those movies, like there's a good discussion to be had about it.
I think it offers something, even if you don't love it. It's going to show you things you haven't seen before. It's going to make you feel a certain way. I think it's absolutely worth seeing, even if somebody doesn't love it. So I'm really happy to hear you talking about it.
Yeah.
My number 8 is Harvest Lake.
Okay.
Have you seen Harvest Lake?
No, sir.
Son of a bitch.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It just makes it harder to talk about. It is on, I believe it's streaming on Amazon Prime if you have that. Because it was a little bit hard to come by. There was a very limited run of Blu-rays that they did, and you could rent it on Vimeo, I think, but now it's finally available to stream on Amazon Prime, or just rent if you don't have Amazon Prime. It is the second movie from Scott Shermer, who made Found a couple years ago.
Oh, okay.
So, and he put out a second movie this year as well called Plank Face, which probably could be in my honorable mentions, but another one of these guys that like, oh, I'm super interested to see, you know, where he goes. I'm going to continue to follow his career because these movies are really interesting. Harvest Lake is very, it was a movie that I watched once and was like, I don't know if I got that. And then it stuck with me exactly like you're talking about Baskin. It's actually interesting that these both occupy the same space on our list, because I think they have a lot in common in terms of kind of a dreamlike vibe to the whole thing, and a movie that, you know, I saw and then couldn't shake and then had to go back and watch again. And then I was like, oh, yeah, no, I'm way on board for this now. It's essentially just a group of friends go up to a lake house. It's Ellie Church and Tristan Risk and three guys. And I don't know their names, but it doesn't matter because Ellie Church and Tristan Risk are in it. So they go up to a lake to hang out, and there's this weird thing in the lake. I don't know if it's an alien. It's never really said. It's a weird sex monster, and it makes everyone just super horny. And
You had me at sex monster.
Yeah,
so
right.
I'm going to add it to my Prime tonight.
Again, there is some insane sexual imagery in this movie. The whole thing just has this weird kind of slow motion dream fantasy vibe to it. It's very beautifully shot, super low budget, but again, just really interesting and kind of haunting in a way that not everything I saw this year was. I recognize it's a movie that is not going to connect with a lot of people. It absolutely did with me. So like I said, it's funny that this and Baskin are kind of being talked about in comparison to one another, because I think they do actually share a lot of things in common. I think it's worth seeing again, even if you don't love it. I think it's worth seeing because I think it's a horror movie that doesn't look or feel like anything else you're going to see right now. And isn't that worth something? You know, I think it's like 80 minutes, even if you say, boy, that was dumb. Why did Bromley waste my time? It's something different. And I'm excited that that's where horror is now, because for years and years, horror has been decried as like, it's all the same. It's slashers. It's torture porn, it's J horror or whatever, it's remakes. people just constantly criticizing the sameness of horror. And say what you want about horror now, but I really don't think you can make accusations of sameness going on. Not when the movies that we've talked about already just couldn't be more different from one another.
I know, we've talked about 8 movies technically already. Maybe 9, actually, if we throw in a little offshoot conversation. And none of them are the same. They're
right.
All different.
Right.
Like, holy shit, that's so cool.
Yes. Yeah.
So, no, I'm very intrigued. Now, I did see it pop up on your list. The other one I was really intrigued by, and I don't know if you saw it because it showed up on Derek's list, but it was The Barn.
I immediately emailed him and said, how do I see The Barn?
He got an online screener because he asked me about it. And I was like, nah, you take it. Because to me, I was just like, it's The Barn. What? I don't have 2 hours. And then I was like, and then he started raving about it. I'm like, oh, son of a bitch.
Yes.
That was a missed opportunity. I'm like,
I really want to see it. He sent me the link to like buy the DVD. And I'm like, oh, I don't want to just like drop $25 on this if I like a blind buy. But
well, if you get it, I'll PayPal you $12.50 and we'll go half on it. And we'll do a swap or something. And we could start The Barn trade swap off. Everybody just pays a buck and we'll just pass it around everybody.
It's interesting that now there are so many ways to see a lot of these indie horror films, even if it's like just renting it on Vimeo or whatever. And yet here's this one that I really want to see that I can't because you can only purchase it physically, which, I'm in support of, but I also want to be able to just rent the fucking thing. But yeah, I totally want to see it now after I saw it pop up on his list.
Yeah. No, that was another one. I'm like, okay. So yeah. And again, I love it that there's so many different things out there these days that like there really is something for any kind of horror fan. So I don't want to hear any, like I mentioned this before, because every like 2 or 3 months, somebody posts some stupid, clickbait article, is horror dead? Well, guess what? 2016 puts the kibosh on that crap. Stop with your clickbait. That's not a thing. Shut up.
It's just something that an ignorant person writes who doesn't see any horror movies, Saw the number 2 in a couple of horror movies released theatrically and decided it was dead. But, this is not a person who is aware of the genre at all.
Yeah. So, it's a wonderful time to be a fan. But, yeah, I love the fact that it's so, just already it's been a very diverse conversation. And I'm curious to see how many overlaps we end up having because I don't know how many we will.
We haven't so far, which is amazing. I think we'll start to get into some now.
So.
Yeah, the top 5 is probably more similar. What is your number 7?
It is one that I know you are a big fan of as well, so I feel like this might be one of our overlaps, but you said you put it on a different list, so maybe not. But I have The Love Witch.
Yes. Love that movie.
Skype High Five, yes. I was so entranced and intoxicated by this movie that I wanted to put on a dress, which I haven't worn a dress in 10 years.
I did too.
And just twirl around and be lost in this timeless era of just I know it was modern times, but it felt so it could have been in the 60s. It could have been now. It didn't matter. I was just lost in this world. And I think what's really interesting is to see everybody sort of bashing it because they're like, oh, well, it's just bashing men and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you're missing the point completely. Annabeller does not give us any sort of concrete answers as to who the quote unquote better sex is in this movie.
Right.
Because, for as much as, you're watching, oh my God, I'm so bad with names tonight.
The lead actress?
Yes.
Samantha
Robinson. Yes. I couldn't remember her character name, but just watching her and she's such a juxtaposition of a character because half of her thing is about pleasing her man and wanting to find true love. And her entire happiness revolves around finding love. Yet she's so empowered with, with her, her supernatural sort of hobbies on the side and stuff like that. That it's such a wonderful dichotomy to watch that. Like somebody who's so powerful yet so vulnerable.
Right.
And I think people miss that. It was fantastic.
There's so many conversations to be had, and it's interesting because I follow Anna Biller on Twitter and she's constantly tweeting out misunderstandings about the movie. And some of that I may take issue with just because at a certain point,
Everybody interprets things their own way.
Exactly. It's not yours to say, like, well, you're misreading the movie. I understand when people, you know, characterize it unfairly, and she kind of wants to speak out against it when they just say, like, well, it's intentional schlock or whatever. And she's like, well, no, it isn't. Just because it looks like this kind of movie that you consider schlocky from the early 70s doesn't mean this is intentional schlock. Or just because Samantha Robinson is giving a stylized performance doesn't mean that she's giving an intentionally bad performance, you know?
Right.
I think she's amazing in that movie. But yeah, what a movie that, you know, you could have so many conversations about. Even if you just want to talk about the aesthetics of it, you could talk about the aesthetics of it for a day. But everything you're saying is completely true, that it is.
It's the first time I've actually wanted to go to a Renaissance fair. You know what I mean? I'm like, that looks like fun. I want to go and have weird people dress me up and do like fake weddings and have like a big white flowy dress. And I'm like, is that what Ren fairs are like? I don't know. But like suddenly now I kind of want to go next year, right. This year. So.
Well, and it's just such an interesting kind of feminist statement, because it isn't just like women are great and men are bad, or women are suppressed and shouldn't we fight back? There are no easy answers. It is providing, like you said, a character who is both good and bad, who is both sort of well-intentioned and completely misguided, who is, like you said, empowered and also driven only by her need for the approval, the affection, the love of a man. It is so interesting, and it is a movie that I've actually watched a couple of times already and want to just continue to watch, because I think there's so much. First of all, I could just watch it forever just because of how it looks, and I'm so in awe of how carefully constructed every piece of it is by Annabella herself, just in terms of the music and the editing and the photography. And I know she didn't shoot it, but the set design and the costumes, I mean, everything about it is so amazing.
And the fact that she shot on film, right, on an independent budget.
Right.
So, I mean, there's something to be said for that, too, because, again, that's pretty ballsy for, like, a studio movie to shoot a movie on film these days. But right. When you have such a limited amount of resources at your disposal to make that decision, and it pays off. Like, it does feel like a movie you know, it's a movie, like, in 20 years you can watch and be like, oh, did I see that back in the 60s? You know what I mean? Like, right. you would get confused, like, oh, it feels like it could have been, like, right out of that era, minus the cell phone and the BMW, I think, at the beginning.
And like so many of the other filmmakers we've been talking about already, here's another name where it's like, well, I can't wait to see what this person does next. And, you know, we've mentioned that about a bunch of filmmakers, and we're talking about films that we really like. It's not like, well, this movie kind of sucked, but I'm interested to see what their next thing is. It's like, I love this. I love this voice. I can't wait to see, you know, what we're going to get next from this filmmaker, and how cool that we can have that conversation about so many of the movies on our list, and we're not even to number 5 yet.
We are not. So what is your number 7?
My number 7 will probably wait, because I suspect it's going to be higher on your list, and that is Don't Breathe.
It is much higher on
okay.
my list.
Okay. Again, like I said, my number 1 I felt strong about. Everything else is like, this is also really good. So I don't mean to say that there are 6 better movies than Don't Breathe. Don't Breathe is one of my very favorite studio horror films this year. There's another one that maybe I like better, or that may just be tied with it, but it's a terrific movie. It is a movie that top critics,
it was savagely unpredictable.
Savagely unpredictable, that movie.
And I will say, when you think about like movie quotes you see in trailers, and you're like, what kind of load of horse shit are they trying to sell me on now? And I get that. You know, there's the quote whores out there. But when I said savagely unpredictable, I meant that 110%. And I feel like I delivered.
You did.
Whether or not you like or dislike that movie, you cannot deny that it is savagely unpredictable.
Some things happen that you probably don't see coming. So we'll wait and we'll talk about Don't Breathe a little bit later when it appears on your list. So let's go to your number 6.
Number 6, again, I had one movie in here and I ended up like swapping it out because it really was like a Sophie's choice this year. I did a lot of switching and hopping around, but I went with The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
That was one that was on my honorable mentions.
And it's weird because it didn't even make my favorites list. But I think in terms of pure horror, because favorites, like on Daily Dead, we can kind of mush all over the genres and stuff, and we don't have to stick to purely horror.
Right.
But I was not – the only thing that intrigued me about going into Autopsy of Jane Doe was the talent with it. And it was Andre Overdahl, Brian Cox, and Emile Hirsch. And I was like, okay, whatever. They're doing an autopsy. What could they possibly do during this movie that I haven't seen? You know, okay, whatever. And then you start going into this movie and things just keep getting weirder and weirder.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if I would say 100% the ending was as satisfying as I was hoping, but I did love that it sort of felt Tales from the Crypt-like, where, you know, and again, it's one of those things you can't talk about unless you've seen it.
Right.
Or I don't want to ruin it for people who haven't seen it, but the turns that that movie takes were so unexpected for me that
it was savagely unpredictable.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say savagely unpredictable. I would say wildly unpredictable.
Ooh. Are you
okay.
listening, IFC? Is that an IFC Midnight?
I don't know who's doing that. I'm gonna keep that one in case I need it for a movie this year. I'm gonna put that in my quote bank.
All right, good.
Just in case. But no, it was just one of those movies where you think you know what this is and you don't. And again, I loved Trollhunters. So that was knowing that Andre was attached to this was very intriguing because I knew it was his first U.S. movie. And I was very curious because I knew regardless of how the movie turned out, I knew the characters were going to be good. And they do this one thing in Autopsy that I thought was so smart. It was so against the grain from any other movie you see. But there's a conversation that Emile Hirsch's character has with his girlfriend about wanting to like leave the family business. It was time for him to go be his own man and all this. Every other movie, as the shit is hitting the fan, and as, you know, there's conflict between father and son, because that, you know, that's bound to happen, that would have been a big moment between those two characters where he blurts out, well, I'm leaving anyway. And then Brian Cox would react to that. It didn't do that at all. It was never an issue. And I love the fact that it was just used as a way to sort of ground Emile's character, but it wasn't used to manipulate the story. And for me, that moment was so subtle and so smart that I knew I was seeing something very different than I would have been, you know, expecting from it. And I loved that. Like, I loved that kind of attention. That's when you know somebody is making choices for the story for the right reasons.
Right.
And I totally dug it.
For me, the moment of the movie was Brian Cox, you know, is kind of the one who's insistent, saying, hey, listen, the whoever it was, the police, the, you know, they need this job done tonight, so I'm going to stay and do it, even though I was supposed to go home. So he's the one who's kind of bound by duty, right? And then there's a certain point in the movie, which is my favorite moment in the movie, where he's like, you're right, let's get the fuck out of here. And it's so great to finally hear a character just say, like, yeah, this is more than I'm willing to deal with. I liked so much of the movie, and like I said, I put it in my honorable mentions. I went so far out of my way to not know anything about it. I knew the title. I sort of knew the premise, and I knew the two actors, and that was it, because I wanted to go in as spoiler-free as possible. So I just had no idea where the movie was going. And for me, and again, it's a quibble, it is kind of that the last act of the movie, like you said. It does kind of put a Tales from the Crypt button on it, which is fine. But the first two-thirds were so strong, and I think this happens to me a lot, and it's just a question of taste, where anytime there's a bunch of weird shit going on in a movie that is unexplainable, as soon as it kind of starts to be explained or resolved in slightly neat ways, it takes some of the excitement away for me, some of the mystery. Which isn't to say that, you know, I want to go the whole movie without ever knowing what the hell is going on, because maybe that would be as equally frustrating for me. I don't know, but once some of those things started to be kind of tied up, not that everything is, you know, in a neat little bow in the movie, but I didn't love where it went versus everything that it kind of set up. And I would say that it's a movie that I want to revisit kind of now knowing what I know, but I also don't know if I can. And this just speaks to my own weirdness, because it's to the movie's credit that the autopsy stuff is like really graphic and upsetting. And I'm just somebody who has crazy issues about the frailty of the human body. And
oh God,
so,
are you kidding? I already told Brian, like, if I die, don't autopsy me. I'm dead. What the right. hell is that going to prove? Just right. put me in a ground or put me in an incinerator. Don't do it. I don't want that. Like, unless I'm murdered and you have to figure out who murdered me.
The answer will always be me. It's fine.
Okay. Well, I'll just make sure to put a note to that. But seriously, I don't want that. Like, after seeing this movie, it makes you realize, like, just, like, how fucking, like, worthless we all are.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, we're just laying on a table. Right. And someone's just going to crack you open like you're a puzzle.
Right.
And it's just, it's terrifying.
Yes.
But again, I think for me, that's what was really effective. That while all this
that is,
other
that
stuff's
is to
going
the movie's
on,
credit, yes.
Yeah. Like all the other stuff that's going on that starts to happen is crazy and intense as it is. But the whole time you're just like, oh my God, they're going to pull my ribs out.
Right.
And
right.
they're going to, oh God, and I'm going to be naked, which is even worse. Like
right.
I should start dieting now. You know, it's just, it's all of your worst fears like in one movie. And I think for me, that's what made it so effective. I was just like, oh dear God, I don't want to die.
Well,
like,
somebody
please invent something before like I hit 60 so I don't have to die.
So many horror films exist to kind of make us more comfortable with death, make us laugh at death. I mean, the reason that we can sit and enjoy 10 Friday the 13th movies is that death has no meaning, basically. It's the punchline of a joke. It's the reason we go see those movies. Well, how are they going to kill people this time? And it's fun. And then you see something like The Autopsy of Jane Doe, where death is very different. And you're like, oh, I'm not comfortable with the reality of death. I'm comfortable with the Jason Voorhees version of death. And so, like I said, it is to the film's credit 100%. But it is the thing that it's going to make that movie hard for me to go back to, because it touches me in a way that I'm not comfortable with.
It's okay, Patrick. If you've been touched, it's okay.
This is a safe place.
So I was going to say, so what you're saying is Jane Doe touched you inappropriately.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. And then peed all over me. My number six, again, we may have to wait because it will probably be higher up on your list. And that is The Witch.
You know, it's really funny.
This better be funny.
It's my number four, but I literally went back and forth as to what my number four should be, because there was two movies and I was like, you know, I had to think about like the movie, like you were saying, sort of these movies that will sort of pick apart for a long time. And it broke my heart, but I kind of, at the last minute, I had The Eyes of My Mother in there and then I swapped out The Witch. And then I've been sitting here the whole time going, oh, should I just go back to The Eyes of My Mother? But yes, The Witch, yeah, it technically right now is my number four.
All right. Should we wait and come back to it then?
We can wait and come back to it, I suppose.
All right. Then we are up to your five.
Probably one that's higher up on your list as well. And it's funny because I didn't even mention this on my favorites list, but The Conjuring 2.
It is in my honorable mentions, but not on my top 10.
Interesting. And again, that was one of those, I mean, I literally could have swapped it out with three other movies. But one, it was a movie that I kind of just was like, all right, whatever. I liked the first Conjuring. We've had this discussion before. I think it was an insanely well-made movie. I have not revisited it since.
I haven't either.
But The Conjuring 2, I really enjoyed. And I think for me, what won me over was the Crooked Man. Which is funny that they're making a movie on The Nun. But for me, it's The Crooked Man that really kind of... I saw it three different times over the summer. I had a chance to actually do that with a few movies this year, which rarely happens. And I was kind of worried, like, upon rewatch that I would be sort of out of it. And I immensely enjoyed it all three times, which was surprising. And as I said, I'm not usually into supernatural movies. But there was just something that I very much enjoyed about watching this family kind of falling apart and seeing them kind of come back together. And I'm not even going to get into the real world logistics of what did it happen, did it not happen. I don't care. This is about the movie. But I think, you know, just watching that, and the only reason I say this is because I recently just rewatched Hard Candy, but I really think Patrick Wilson is probably one of the more underrated actors out there these days.
He's really good.
He really is. It's funny because I never really thought that about him, and I was like, whatever. But as I kind of revisited that, like, about a month ago, and then over winter, like sort of that Christmas break, they were showing Little Children on cable. You know, has lots of sweaty Patrick Wilson in it. he's very glossy, isn't he? He's very smooth and glossy. And even Watchmen, he sort of plays the most uninteresting character of that group, and yet he's really good.
Yeah, he is.
I think Conjuring 2 really made me appreciate that there is a charisma there. And it finally took somebody like James to kind of bring it out. He was even like a good douchebag in 18, you know? So it won me over. I knew it would be good. You know what I mean? Like, it's James Wan, it's Conjuring. I mean, it's not going to be bad. But there's certain moments in that movie that really won me over, you know, the Can't Help Falling in Love, just cause that was, one of my favorite Elvis songs.
Yeah.
As you know, like as a teenager and stuff. And so kind of seeing that moment, like it's such a rare moment that you get in a horror movie these days. It was that for me made it something a little bit different, you know? And again, I'm very surprised that it even would make my top 10 just because I was so lukewarm to the first one, you know? I was very surprised, at how much I ended up really enjoying it. And enjoying it multiple times. So,
yeah, it's when I was considering, you know, doing like a top five just studio horror movies, obviously it would have been on there because it is a really good studio horror film. It's incredibly well made, like you said, because James Wan really is, I think, one of the best right now in terms of technical filmmaking. He knows how to put a horror movie together. It, for me, was a little bit shooting in a lot of different directions story-wise. I thought it had a little bit of trouble kind of focusing in on one thing. I like how...
But did it need to?
Well, no.
Does a movie need to focus on one thing?
No, but I think it's...
I'm just asking. I'm not bullying.
No, I know you're not. But I think in trying to service too many things, I think it did a disservice to all of them. Do you know what I mean? Like, there are movies that can juggle 10 balls and do it fine. I think this movie didn't quite do it. I think it took on maybe a little bit too much, and had it been a little bit more focused, for me, I think story-wise, it would have worked better. I like, you know, the portrayal of the Warrens by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. I like their relationship. I like that the movie is invested kind of in their love story, the love story between a married couple. I think by The Conjuring 2, there's almost a little bit too, it's like almost a little bit too invested in almost myth-making about the Warrens, and that their love is the greatest love, and that they are almost superheroes. I think it reaches levels of almost histrionics at times. Again, I say this as somebody who really likes the movie, who thinks it's scary, who, like you, likes that, you know, Elvis scene. There's all kinds of good things about it. And earlier when I was talking about there are other movies that, you know, objectively are better made than The Boy and aren't on my list, and yet The Boy is, the movie that I was thinking of is The Conjuring 2. Like, there are people who are listening who are very upset that I would put The Boy in my top 10 and not The Conjuring 2. And again, this just speaks to what is the movie that reaches out and grabs you specifically in whatever way. And The Conjuring 2, I found myself appreciating more than loving. Do you know what I mean?
Gotcha. I'm just still laughing in my head the fact that you were talking about juggling balls.
Always.
Always.
I'm all about the ball juggling. And actually, that idea of appreciating versus loving is going to come up again probably fairly soon. But The Conjuring 2, Ouija 2, The Boy... There's another one I'm forgetting. Oh, Don't Breathe. And there's one other studio movie that came out this year that are all really strong, I think.
Yeah, I would agree there's a few more than one, but...
Well, We'll see. So maybe that depends on how we define studio. Also,
well, I was gonna say also, and none of those, and actually, the two movies I'm thinking of didn't even make my list. So, okay.
All right. Well, now I'm curious to see what those are. So we'll have to get back to those when we're done. Where are we at?
Five.
My number five is Darling.
Okay.
From Mickey Keating. Again, people's heads are exploding because I put Darling on my list and left out a bunch of movies that people love a lot more. And that's fine. I saw Darling back when it hit, you know, VOD or however it... It's not an IFC. It's a Glass Eye Pix. So it hit VOD when it came out maybe last April. And I understood exactly what it was doing. He's essentially just remaking Repulsion, you know. And yet I just felt like, yeah, but I don't care because this little 80-minute black and white thing is really working for me. I recognize that it may lack originality, but I thought the execution was really good. It grabbed me in such a way. For a while, Darling was like my favorite horror movie of the year for a couple months there. I loved Lauren Ashley Carter in the movie. She had a really good year, I think. I mean, I know that she often does, but she pops up in so many of these movies, and it was nice to see her get such a showcase role where she's essentially the whole movie. It's her and then kind of Mickey Keating's filmmaking. He had two movies out this year. Again, Mike Flanagan, Scott Shermer, Mickey Keating. I think you liked one of his movies better than I did, and I liked Darling better.
Well, it's funny because everything that you said about Darling could literally have been said about Carnage Park.
Right. And Carnage Park, I watched and I was like, yeah, okay, I get it. But it's doing this, this, and this, and it's not doing anything for me, which I know is exactly how people felt about Darling. And yet, you know, one spoke to me, one spoke to you. And who are we to fight with that?
And here we are.
But Mickey Keating makes, I don't know, a movie a week. And
I know, and he's like 20. You know what I mean? Like, I have wasted my entire life. Like, literally, I have done nothing. Like, it's exhausting just to think about what that kid does, you know, with his time. It's amazing. It's brilliant. And, you know.
He's got one or two still to come, and I'm, like we said with a number of other filmmakers, I'm interested to see where his career goes. I hope that it starts to carve out a little more space for himself, you know, the way that Ricky Bates from the very first movie was like, here's who I am as a filmmaker. I'm still kind of waiting for that from Mickey Keating because I think Pod might have been his most original movie, and yet it's the one that I'm probably least likely to revisit.
Same here.
And so, you know, both Darling and Carnage Park felt a little bit like exercises. Like, I'm going to make this kind of movie. Now I'm going to make this kind of movie. And I really want to see what a Mickey Keating movie looks like, not a Mickey Keating version of another kind of movie, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think also what's really cool about watching his films is you can see progression as a filmmaker. Every movie, there's just a little bit more in terms of like a smoothness in a style. And I think, you know, if Darling and Carnage Park are any indication of his potential, like, I'm very excited to see what, because I don't know if both, because I know he's got two things, like you mentioned, I think that are already done and wrapped. I don't know if they're coming out this year or not, but I'm hoping.
He just wrapped his third. Okay, good.
Oh, good. Did he do it like while we were on this podcast?
Yeah, well, since we started talking about Darling.
Yeah, and he found distribution. And I think it's already slated to play every festival for the rest of the year.
Larry Fessenden is in it and gets killed.
Well, of course. But who doesn't love watching Larry haplessly get killed? I mean, I love Larry. He's the best. So, he's a hell of a filmmaker. And the only reason I can't really speak to Darling is because I actually started to watch it on Netflix a little while ago, and then my stupid internet froze, and I just kind of never got back to it.
Yeah. You okay?
Oh. Sorry, I took a sip of coffee. Oh, I went down the wrong pipe. Sorry about that.
Oh, no. Oh, dear.
It's, yeah, fourth cup, so I'm going.
What is your number four? Oh, your number four, we already said, is The Witch.
Is The Witch. It used to be Eyes on My Mother, and it pained me. There's two movies that I really wanted to put on this list, and yet We should have just done a 15, really. I mean, for Christ's sakes, at this point.
We just keep talking about the movies that didn't make the list that we wanted to put on there.
So we might as well make it. It's an unofficial 15. Because for me, both of those movies sort of tapped into a really interesting perspective on women in society in very different ways. You know, seeing, you know, Anna Taylor... Oh my God! Why am I so terrible with names today? She's going to be in Split.
Yeah, I know who she is. Anna Taylor Johnson. No, just Johnson. Kidding. No, I'm kidding. Say, no, that's the like kid Aaron. From Kick-Ass. Yeah.
I was like, what are they, sister brother? What the hell's going on here? Sister brother or siblings?
Sister brother is Mickey Keating's next movie.
I would watch that. Are you kidding?
It's Anya Taylor-Joy.
Anna Taylor-Joy. Yes. And again, and I will say Split, I think, comes out next week. And she's really, really strong in that. She's not so much the focus in it, but when she's in it, she's really great. But for me, you know, and again, it's one of those things, you know, everybody's arguing, is the witch horror? Is the witch not horror? It has a satanic goat. It's horror.
It's 100% horror.
I mean, come on.
100%.
It has a satanic goat. It's horror. It has, like... Again, speaking to very uncomfortable scenes, and I don't want to give it away for those
right.
who
no,
maybe
there's
haven't
a thing that happens
at...
in the first 20 minutes that, like,
and you're
it's
like,
a horror movie.
You're like, oh, dear God, that is one of the worst. And they don't even show anything. Right. And it's still one of the worst things I have seen slash not seen all year.
Yes.
And I'm like, for me, like, to do that, like, you have to be able to, like, then keep just – twisting that nail or twisting that screw right in into your audience and just really give it to him. And I think he does. Like watching the scene with the little kids in the room, and you, I'm so frustrated because her brother and sister are just the biggest assholes, puritanical assholes, you know, that I've ever seen.
That was the original title of the movie.
Puritanical assholes. It was the name of my band in high school.
They couldn't sell it at Walmart, so they had to change it to The Witch.
To The Witch.
Yeah.
Somebody should make puritanical asshole shirt because I would wear that. But just like as it keeps getting worse for this poor, it's like seriously, like the you know like the kid who has like the no good terrible bad day. The book you read as a kid,
Alexander.
You know? Alexander is terrible, no good bad day. Like that's like her. This is like for adults because seriously, it just keeps getting worse for this poor girl, and there's literally. Nothing she can do. And then finally, you know, it goes to where it goes. And you're just like, all right, like way to go, Robert Eggers. Like I will see again. He's one of those. I think that might've been his first feature film.
It was.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll watch whatever. And again, I want to point out also a lot of my favorite movies this year were from first time directors.
Isn't that amazing?
Holy shit. Like that's so great. I mean, it just shows that there's a lot of people who grew up really loving movies who are getting to make movies now. And that's awesome.
And they're making really good shit. Again, like I said, they're not movies that were like, okay, that was rough, but maybe the next one will be good. It's like, oh no, this first one is great. And I can't wait to see what's next.
Yeah.
The Witch for me is a weird one because I saw it theatrically and I know that expectations played some part in it because I saw it opening weekend, but because it had done the festival rounds already and had been called not just one of the best horror movies of the year, but like I heard it referred to as one of the best horror movies ever made. I think Sam Zimmerman might have said something like that. So my expectations were pretty high. And
see, but that's not either. I never buy into hyperbole at all.
No, I don't either. But just hearing that it touched somebody that way, you know, I wasn't like, well, then this thing better blow my hair back because I know that it might not. But just hearing that it gave somebody that strong of a response.
Yeah.
It just puts in your mind like, oh, this could be something special, you know?
This is it. This is the one.
Right. So it wasn't like I sat down like, you better be fucking awesome. But I knew that, okay, at least one person who knows something really responded to this. So there's something to this. So, and I saw it and I will fully admit, and I think I said as much in my write-up at Daily Dead, like, I didn't connect emotionally to this one as much as most of the other movies on my list. And the reason that I'm putting it on my list is because I just cannot deny that I think it may be like the best made horror movie of the year in terms of photography and art direction and script. I mean, everything about it is pretty incredible. And in 20 years, this is still a horror movie that we're going to be talking about. You know, this is, I think, an all-timer. And I'm not positive, you know, as much as I enjoy The Boy, it's not an all-timer.
It is to somebody, damn it.
It is to the person who wrote and directed it. It is The Witch, I think, truly is kind of a modern classic, and I think will have a long life. And so, I'm so sorry. I think for me to deny that just because, so this is the movie earlier I was talking about, a movie that I admire more than I love. And The Witch is certainly that. And I truly, for the last 4 months or so, have intended to watch it again. I've still only seen it the one time. And it's been in my head a lot, and I really need to sit down and watch it again, because I suspect I would have a stronger reaction, kind of divorced from the hype of that first experience. Right, exactly. And but I had to include it on this list just because I think it's such a well-constructed film that I think will only grow in my estimation as time goes on.
Definitely. Yeah, it's one of those, like, I don't know how much there is in terms of a rewatch value. I haven't gone back to see it again either yet. It's stuck with me. Like I said, I love movies that sort of become part of you. And The Witch very much was that. It's one of those movies, you know, whether, again, you love it or you hate it, that last 10 minutes, it sticks with you.
Yeah.
You don't, it's with you. And there's also other parts of that movie that just really dig in a way that a lot of movies don't. Yeah. So, again, if there's a movie that, you know, maybe for other reasons, you know, other people might not like it, but it can stick with me, like, I will always appreciate that over maybe a quote-unquote flawless masterpiece of a movie. You know what I mean?
Right. And I just
it is a masterpiece on its own too. So it's sort of a double win there.
Well, right, it is such its own thing, and I have to give it so much credit for really sticking to being what it is, just even down to the language that, you know, the characters are using. There's another version of that movie that's like, sure, it can look this way, it could be about all this stuff, but, you know, can they sound a little bit more contemporary? But the movie is so committed to being the thing that it is, and I really respect that.
Yeah. I mean, there's very few films that feel so authentic.
Yeah.
As The Witch does.
So that was your four. My number four may be higher on your list, may not be on your list at all. And that is The Invitation.
You know what? I feel like, and honestly, I was trying to find, but I've switched computers since we did this for last year. So I couldn't find my list from last year. And I swear I put it on last year. And I think because of that, I took it off of this list.
Yeah. It was not.
It was where Hush was.
Okay.
Or actually, no, it was, I switched that out for The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Okay. Well,
because I honest to God, I feel like I've been talking about The Invitation for like 3 years now.
Well, you probably have.
But for very good reason, because right. There, again, it's one of those movies there's a lot to talk about.
Well, and in a way, I'm glad, because now we get to talk about two movies instead of one. We got to talk about Jane Doe, and now we get to talk about The Invitation. So before a week ago, it was not even on my list. Like, I saw it when it came out. I liked it. Kind of what we're talking about with The Witch. I respected the filmmaking. Thought it was very well done. Didn't necessarily feel a ton about it. And then last weekend, Friday night maybe, Thursday night, I don't know, it doesn't matter. But my wife was trying to catch up on some 2016 movies because she was trying to come up with her top 10 to run on the site. And I was like, well, I don't know if this will be on your list, but I think it's kind of your bag. It's called The Invitation. It was on Netflix. So I put it on and I ended up sitting and watching the whole thing with her. And really gained a brand new appreciation for that film. And I think a lot of it has to do with having seen it once. It made me feel a certain way watching it the first time. You know, obviously so much of that movie is about feeling really uncomfortable and constantly switching back and forth between, like, should I be feeling this way or am I being paranoid? Which is exactly what the Logan Marshall Green character is going through, right? Is he...
Right.
Is he just being paranoid or is something up? And so knowing where it was going and then watching it again a second time gave me such a new appreciation for the way that it is constructed and for the way that Karin Kusama kind of plays that game. It is brilliant filmmaking in terms of like, well, this could be nothing or this could be super fucked up. And I just couldn't. I was like, well, this movie's way better than I gave it credit for. And so I'm actually really glad that I watched it a second time, because I don't know that it would have been on my list had I not revisited it. But having seen it a second time, I was like, oh, man, this is a really, really terrific movie. Again, I liked it before because it's beautifully shot and the performances are good and it's almost savagely unpredictable. But I just gained a whole new appreciation for just the filmmaking aspects, giving it a second viewing.
Yeah, I would call that one emotionally unpredictable.
Emotionally unpredictable doesn't sound as good on a poster.
It doesn't, but it's a little more accurate. Now, I think I've said this probably 100 times because I believe it like in my very soul. But I think for me, like, I love Logan Marshall Green in that movie, an actor that I've always been kind of like, about. Right.
Yeah, well, because of fucking Prometheus.
He wasn't even the problem with that movie.
No, but he was a problem with that movie.
He was, but
how his much character, was... not his performance. It was his character.
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, that's, he can't help how his character is written, you know. Anyway, but for as good as he is in that movie, for me, the performance is John Carroll Lynch. And, you know, I saw the film the first time at South by Southwest, I think 2015. And then when they did the theatrical release for it this year, we went and saw it at ArcLight. And both times I didn't breathe when he talked, because the way that he pulls you into that story, like imagine sitting in a room, it's some dude just drops all of that stuff on you, like the way that he does, and just his delivery in those moments. And then that reveal of just the horribleness and like how quickly he's come to peace with, I mean, it's just like, holy crap. Like it's such a befuddling moment, because you're like, it's so enigmatically told,
right?
Yet what he's really, the truth of what he is saying is so awful.
Well, but that story, that scene that you're talking about encapsulates, I think, what's so great about the movie, because at once it is both horrifying and really sad and also really uncomfortable, just because all of a sudden this guy starts dropping this insanely dark personal story and you're like, I don't know how to respond, you're a stranger. And the combination of those three things is like what carries through the entire movie, right? It's a super essentially horrifying movie. It's very sad because it's really about grief in so many ways, and yeah, it's super uncomfortable. I can't remember who it was or where it was, but I recently heard someone talking about the movie and they called out a scene that I was like, oh, fuck, yeah, I forgot about that. And when I rewatched it, I was again marveling at how great of a scene it is. And it's when John Carroll Lynch, when the one friend decides she's going to leave the party early.
And he goes to the car with her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're just like, what is happening? And I guess, spoilers, like, you don't ever find out.
No. So, spoiler, non-spoiler.
Right. I mean, like, there's so much tension just in like, you don't have any reason, but right, but you don't have any reason to think that anything's up, right? But because you're watching it through the eyes of Logan Marshall Green, you're just like, yeah, but something's up, right? Like something terrible is happening. I don't know. It's really well done.
Yeah. And I think I cried again when I saw it the second time, because it is definitely about grief. Although watching it now sort of in this political climate, I mean, there's something to be said for folks who blindly follow.
Sure.
As well. And but just the scene of him, and I think it's when he like lays on the pillow.
Yeah.
You know, Arrival destroyed me emotionally this year. Like, yeah, no other movie has destroyed me in a long time. Like, probably since, like, seeing Pan's Labyrinth and Children of Men as a double feature. But I would say on a scale of 1 to Arrival, like, Invitation was like a 7 to 8. Because that scene with the pillow, and I just, your heart breaks.
Yeah.
Because it's just so much. There's so much in that moment. And again, I think that's a testament to Logan as an actor, like that it's not a big moment for his character, but it's a big emotional moment without him even having to say anything.
And it fills in so much of what we have seen before that, you know?
Yeah. And also, let's just, you know, for the record, point out the fact that Jennifer's Body is really good and people should go revisit it.
I still need to. I've been meaning to for a few years, but I will, I promise.
And when you revisit it, you will realize how grossly overlooked that movie has been.
I may. What is your number three?
My number three is The Wailing.
Oh, okay. Another one that was in my honorable mentions.
Yes. This will tell you how much I love. And again, it's one of those things, like, I can't even believe how much Supernatural stuff is on my list this year. But, you know, The Wailing clocks in well over 2 hours, which, of course, you know, some people complain about. I don't care. You know, if a movie is really great and it's 4 hours, I don't care. You know, I'll watch all 4 hours. But honest to God, the first time I watched The Wailing, I literally could have watched it again. And that's, you're talking like 5 hours of your life. But I was so, that movie just starts off in, like, it, and it's something like Jonathan, my boss over at Daily Dead, was talking about, is like, there's three very definite acts to this movie.
Yeah.
And each of them have such a different tone to them. And the way it all comes together, like, it is magnificent. And I just, like, every moment of that movie, I was like, I remember, because I was watching it, and I think Brian had to come out to ask me something, and I think I was, like, so caught up in the moment, I was like, what? And he was like, okay, take it down a notch. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just really caught up in this moment, and you come out. But no, I was so blown away by it, and I didn't know anything about it, like, going into it. I knew it was from South Korea. That is literally all I knew. I requested a screener.
I think that's all I knew as well.
And I just knew, like, I'd heard some decent things about it. And I was like, you know what? Let's go for it. And it just blew me the hell away. And the way that they put all that together, I mean, it almost felt like an extended episode of X-Files in a way. I don't even know how to describe it, but the ending, just for me, like, you think you know where this movie is going to take you, it doesn't. And it's really good at that.
It is savagely unpredictable. Just say it.
Sorry, I was coughing off microphone.
It is, but it, I mean, like, every 15 minutes, you're kind of like, wait, where is this movie going? Because it seems to shift, and it's all of a piece. It's not like it's not playing fair, but there is just absolutely no way to know from the first half hour of that movie what the last half hour is going to be. There's even a scene at one point, and I won't spoil anything, where a character explains, here's exactly what's happening. This person who you thought was this is actually this, and I'm the one you can trust. And then, I don't know, 15 minutes later, you're like, wait,
what?
Even that wasn't true. I mean, you just keep getting the rug pulled out from under you. And it's insanely ambitious and crazy, and, you know, there were two kind of big horror movies that came out of South Korea this year. It was The Wailing and Train to Busan, and I think both are on my honorable mentions, and I think both are really good and interesting for very different reasons. Like, Train to Busan, I think, is so much, it's more kind of on the surface. I mean, there's definitely an emotional hook to it, although that's being really sold by a lot of people, that they're saying, like, oh my gosh, Train to Busan made me cry. And I did not have that reaction. I understand what people are responding to, but I didn't have that. But it's more about execution. It's more about, like, let's take this very familiar idea, zombies, and let's just execute it in an interesting, competent way. Whereas The Wailing is like, I'm going to show you a movie you've never seen before and would never be able to describe to someone else, right? And so I feel like The Wailing is much more kind of my bag. But I also know that I can't, I have not wrapped my head around it. Like, I need to see it again. I was listening to Shockwaves, and Elric Kane on Shockwaves was talking about how he really liked it, but he feels like he almost doesn't know enough culturally to get the whole thing, that it's like, it's so specific to its country that there are certain things that he's missing. And I that articulated something for me where I was like, yeah, maybe that's it, because there's things in that movie that I'm like, this is almost too much to wrap my brain around. So I need to see it again before I could even consider
putting it on my list. Well, I think speaking to that, I think obviously, you know, beyond the supernatural elements that are going on in there, I mean, it's obviously a movie about xenophobia. And I think what actually helped me in terms of seeing that is I actually saw, and I never really realized that there were these tensions that existed between the Japanese and Korean countries. I just didn't realize that existed, you know, because I'm over here and they don't teach you that stuff in school. And so I had the context of The Handmaiden.
I was just going to say, isn't that interesting that we got both of those movies?
This year,
yeah.
And so I think knowing that political context and then seeing how it plays out in The Wailing, and a very different, obviously way different approach than The Handmaiden, way less sexy than The Handmaiden. speaking of juggling balls.
Speaking of vagina bells.
Vaginal in nature. you know, it's that for me was able to put that fear around, you know, as, and I hate saying it because that's what they refer to, but they call him the Jap.
Right.
And that's not a term that I would ever use, but that's how they refer to him. And it's the character. And so to have, you know, knowing that they're worried about this man who's from a different country, who doesn't fit their world, and all their fear like lies on him. You know, I was able, because of The Handmaiden, to kind of put that into some sort of context and be like, ah, okay, I get it. So that helped for me. But I get that. I mean, there is some very specific things, you know, sometimes when I'm watching like J horror, like I don't always connect with it because I'm not really immersed in that culture enough to be able to understand certain aspects of it.
Right.
Which I'm, you know, and I think that's why I've been pushing myself lately to watch a lot more foreign horror movies, because I know that's my weak spot. I want to open like that perspective up a little bit. So I think for me, the fact that we got three brilliant films out of South Korea this year is, again, how lucky are we?
Yeah.
You know, and that we would get them over here too.
And it's exciting to see The Wailing show up on so many lists, not just
I'm very surprised, because honestly nobody's really been talking about it. Like once Busan came out, like that's what everybody's talking about. For good reason, you know. But I mean, and again, I admitted to you earlier, I haven't even seen
right.
I've just literally not had a good 2 hours to do that. So it might have made my list.
And Train to Busan is very accessible, you know what I mean? Like zombies, I get it. And it, like I said, it's executed well, but it is very accessible. And that is not a word I would use to describe The Wailing. And I think that's why I'm excited to see it show up, not just on your list, but on other lists that I've heard, because it is not just, you know, a South Korean horror film, but it is specific to that culture. It's incredibly long. It's insanely ambitious. It is a movie that is so difficult to classify, to compare to anything else. You know, The Wailing is like, well, it's zombies on a train. Okay, I get that. Or not The Wailing, Train to Busan is, well, it's zombies on a train. The Wailing, like, where would you even start to say, well, here's what the movie is about? You can't.
No, because it's like part of it feels like a supernatural movie, and then part of it kind of feels like you're in the middle of like Serpent in the Rainbow,
right?
Almost. And you're like, now I feel like I'm Bill Pullman. Like, it's crazy. What I do want to say before we move on to the next movie is that The Wailing actually had my second favorite kid performance of the year. And I don't know the actress's name who played Ho Jen, but she was amazing.
Yeah.
That kid was so good at being so fucking intimidating. Like, if that kid looked at me like right now and said, sit the fuck down, I'd be like, yes, I will do that. Like, her delivery was so good in it. And honestly, like, my favorite was Lula Wilson in Ouija. Just because she does so much with that character, and she's so good.
Yeah.
And she just plays it so dryly that you can't help but love that. But yeah, I just thought Ho Jen was just like this really wonderfully demented sort of all of a sudden, you know, problem child, like weird. It just, again, you can't put it into one specific container.
Right.
It hits a lot of different notes, but I think it hits them all really well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. There's another Kim Soo-hwan in Train to Busan is another really amazing child performance. So once you see that, you will either have a third favorite or a tie for a second, because she gives a really terrific kid performance as well. But yeah, I think, I mean, I'm again, super happy to hear you talking about that movie, and I'm really excited that like our lists are so different, and it's not as though there's any movie on either one of our lists where we're like, what, you're fucking crazy, only because you haven't seen The Boy. But had you seen it,
maybe I don't even know that I would argue because again,
no, you might not. I don't know.
It's you know, I mean, one, it's just it's so hard to make a movie these days and make a movie that's even like moderately entertaining. And the fact that I mean, realistically, we could have made a list of 50 horror movies that came out in 2016, and I would say more than 50% of those movies were pretty good.
Sure.
To good, to great. Do you know what I mean?
They're movies that you would recommend to horror fans. Even if you're like, you know, this isn't great, I didn't love it, it's not my favorite, but, you know, there's enough good segments in Holidays that I would tell someone to watch Holidays, even if I don't think the whole thing works.
Yeah, or even like Southbound or like Lights Out. I mean, there's a lot of really like strong possibilities, whether I don't think you liked Lights Out.
That was so earlier, there was a movie where I said there was like all but one studio horror film. It was Lights Out is the one that I am not a big fan of.
Gotcha. Okay.
Which, whatever. Again, a lot of people liked it, and that's great. So I'm not here to shit on Lights Out. That was just the one that didn't work for me. But I didn't want to talk shit in case
it showed up. Stop telling me what to like, Patrick.
In case it showed up on your list.
I will not conform to your expectations.
Speaking of studio horror films, that brings me to my number three, and that is 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Interesting.
You didn't like it?
I liked everything until she got out.
Okay, and that's totally understandable. And I will admit that
that movie up until that point was a 5 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, I will admit that that's my least favorite stuff in the movie. I've certainly,
and I can say that she gets out because they show that in the trailer, right. So I don't feel like I'm giving anything away there.
I've come to terms with some of it. It's still my least favorite stuff in the movie. All the stuff in the little underground house is. Like you said,
absolutely.
It's a 5 out of 5. It's one of the best horror films of the year. I don't love the stuff outside as much, but I've come to terms with it, whatever. But it ranks this high on the list just because of all the stuff before that. I think it's so strong. I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead has never been better. I think John Goodman arguably has never been better. And what's his name?
I have loved John Goodman for like forever. And to see people like finally... getting like how brilliant he really was on Roseanne.
He's one of these guys who like anything he shows up in, he's going to improve and has always been that way. I mean, he usually gets more character parts, but you know, like Matinee is one of my favorite movies ever. And you watch that and you're just like, well, John Goodman should be a leading man in everything because he's just always great. But yeah, 10 Cloverfield Lane, I think gave him a chance to do something that he hasn't gotten to do a lot of. And God damn it, does he crush it. And what's his name? The third guy in the movie, John Gallagher Jr., the guy from the news.
Who's also in Hush.
I was just going to bring up, has had a good year too, because he showed up in Hush, playing two very different roles.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of those, like, if I would have liked that finale, and again, for me, because it's the finale that makes it the title that it is.
Exactly.
If I would have liked that part more, it probably would have made my list.
Sure.
But for me, it just felt like they had this really amazing, intense, intimate, like thriller.
Which they basically did.
And then they were like, you know, we should put out a Cloverfield movie. Let's go shoot some stuff.
I think that's basically what happened. I know Damien Chazelle wrote the original script, and I think his script was, okay, we're in this underground thing. And then I think when it got, you know, picked up by Bad Robot and it was like, well, let's make it a Cloverfield movie. I think that's when they started to add in the other stuff.
And I just didn't. I mean, and I say this as somebody who adores Cloverfield. I just don't think it worked for this. Like, had it just stuck to its intentions for the first two acts and like really stuck to that. I think it would definitely be on my list.
I think it may. Have you seen it more than once?
I saw it twice.
Okay.
Second time I was at the drive-in, so it was actually because I took Brian, which was probably the worst idea because it's such a dark movie, and at times where you're like, what the hell is going on? Not bad movie at the drive-in. So for me, like to go back and revisit it, and then barely be able to see it on a revisit, like I don't feel like I gained much from that experience. If it pops up, I don't know if it's popped up on any of Amazon Instant or Prime or. Netflix.
I don't think it has, but I want to watch it a second.
I paid for it twice, so I feel like the third time like I pay my Amazon fees, I pay my Netflix fees, I can watch it for my membership.
I hear you. I started to put it on the other day on Blu-ray for Erica because I'm like, this is totally going to be her bag. But she was trying to get some work done or something, and I was like, you know what, you have to be able to pay attention. Like, I want you to see this. So I turned it off, but I do want to watch it a second time because I wonder if, again, knowing where it's going,
if you would see the other stuff differently.
Yeah, I think, because I do think some of that is kind of woven through those first two thirds where it's like, well, it could be, it's kind of like The Invitation where it's like, it could be this or it could be nothing. Both are equally kind of dangerous, and ultimately the answer is like, well, actually it's both. And that idea is interesting to me. Again, I'm in complete agreement that that stuff is my least favorite stuff in the movie, but I love that first, you know, two-thirds or a little bit more so much that that's why it ranks so high. And again, this is a first-time filmmaker making just an incredible debut. This is like such a confidently made movie that does so many things right in terms of the way that it's shot and creates believable geography of the space. We always know where we are, and it doesn't repeat itself in terms of how it films that space. I just think it's so creative in the way that it's put together.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I definitely do want to go back and watch it one of these days. Although you've given me a couple of new movies I need to watch first.
That's right.
But no, I mean, there's definitely a lot of really good stuff in there. To call it 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah.
And then to have the Cloverfield stuff feel so tacked on, it didn't do anything for me. And sure, that bummed me out. Cause like, as soon as I was like, oh sweet, this movie is connected to Cloverfield. Fuck yeah. And then it just, I mean, again, it's one of those, you know, first time I saw it, I was like, okay. Then I, you know, went for a revisit and I was like, I can't see shit now. So this isn't doing anything for me. You know, maybe now at home, kind of seeing it properly, you know, as my second time really seeing it, you know, maybe it'll work a little bit better. But there's no denying that John Goodman has never been better than he has been in that movie. And of course, because it's a genre movie, he will never get any sort of, you know, professional recognition, I should say, for it. But we all love him, so that should be enough for him.
Yeah. What is your penultimate movie, your number two choice?
Number two is Don't Breathe.
There it is.
There
Savagely
it is, folks.
Unpredictable.
You've been waiting for it, and I delivered. Just set it right up and knocked it right out of the park.
So that was my number seven, but it is one of the few movies that has shown up. I think it's just that and The Witch, right, that have shown up on both of our lists?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Because I'm pretty sure our number ones are not the same.
I don't think so.
So yeah, I mean, again, I don't even know what I can say about Don't Breathe that I haven't yammered on about forever. But I will say there's no denying that any horror fan who had a proper Thanksgiving dinner this year did not look at their turkey baster in a wholly different way this year.
And it's like, it's such a small moment. I mean, it's so gross when it's first introduced. Just
it's
at, like,
so in your face too.
Just kind of what's suggested that is being done, and the moment that we're all talking about that has become so iconic, and the reason that this movie now owns kind of the turkey baster. It's almost an afterthought. You know what I mean? Like,
it's not even what makes the movie so great. Like,
right, but the screening I was at, it was like, it really did surprise everyone in a way, because it was like, it's introduced and we're like, yeah, okay, this is what he's using it for, and that's gross and that's upsetting. And then you kind of just forget the turkey baster, but then it becomes Chekhov's gun where it's like, no, we're going to use the turkey baster. And the payoff is very rewarding.
It is. And again, it's one of those movies, like, I never really had given much thought to Stephen Lang, and I don't mean that is, you know, downplaying who he is as an actor. I don't, you know, Avatar is not my bag. I don't really watch Salem, so I was kind of ambivalent towards his being in this movie. Like, I knew it was Jane Levy, who I was, you know, already good with because of Evil Dead. And, you know, and but the way that he is such a force in this movie, every single time I saw it, like, holy crap, like, you literally stop breathing. And again, to have a filmmaker that can literally manipulate his audiences the way that Fetty doesn't with this movie. Cause I'm not the only person who has said that they've like literally felt like they felt themselves catching their breath in the movie. And the way that he can do that, he's not even in the room. Like, it's not him doing anything different. You know what I mean? Like, it's a universal experience. And like, that to me is like the earmark of a really, truly well-made movie, a powerful movie, and just one that completely catches you by surprise again and again. And what I also loved about it, too, is that nobody wins in this movie. And it was something I talked about with sort of my sort of complicated female characters this year. It's like, Jane Levy, isn't that really that likable? And in fact, in the original script, like, you know, Fetty talked about the fact that she was even far more manipulative in terms of making the guys stay because she was so desperate to get the hell out of town.
Right.
So her character even took it further than we see in this version. And she's only somewhat likable as a character. You still root for her because you just know that it's like rooting for the bad guy versus the badder guy.
Well, but they attempt to make her sympathetic by creating the little sister who she's trying to help. And one of the movies, I would argue it's kind of a misstep. And again, I say this as somebody who really likes the movie, is the home life that is presented is almost like a cartoon of kind of
as somebody who grew up in a trailer park, believe me, I was like, of course she lives right. in a trailer with her right. trashy mom
right.
and her mom's trashy boyfriend, fifth husband, whatever.
Right.
And I'm just like, I mean, I, like I said, I grew up in a trailer park. I had, you know, went to dozens upon dozens of houses, and nothing like that ever existed in any of my friends' homes.
There's a way to set some of that same stuff up without indulging in quite so many movie cliches. You know?
I feel like that was a pickup shot. I don't feel like that was something that was in the original
script. It may be. It may have been one of those things where it was like, we have to make her more sympathetic, and here's how we do it, you know?
Yeah. It almost felt like that moment, like that that scene was out of, and I say this lovingly, out of a Rob Zombie movie.
They did wander in off the set of 31.
Yeah, for like a brief moment, we're like, oh, God, what's happening? But yeah, no, I agree that scene is a little cringeworthy, especially for me, because I'm just like, yes, okay, I get it.
Right. Here's what it's like. Oh,
exactly.
No.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, of course. So,
but that,
you know,
I said that screening that I went to, it was like the opening night of the Bruce Campbell Fest. And I think I said this on the podcast a week or two ago. Was like probably my most fun screening of the year, except maybe The Beyond when Fritzy was playing live. But like, just what a fucking fun audience movie that is, you know?
Definitely. It's funny because like the second time that I saw it, it was at a press screening, but they invited the public in too, which was the weirdest thing ever. Because it was like having... Not that I'm an elitist, but it's just weird to have...
Oh, here she goes.
Well, no, it's weird to have people
Meryl
who are...
Meryl Streep over here.
but people on their phones during a screening because
right,
they're
right,
general
right.
public
right.
and the rest of us know better. But some of the people that kind of came in from the street, like that were just there to kind of like watch it as fans, like listening to them react to it, because I knew what was coming. You know, everybody else in that room had no idea. I was the only person in there seeing it for a second time. And just to watch everybody watch that movie was so much fun.
Yeah.
And the turkey baster scene killed. It was like these two older ladies, probably in their 40s, were sitting in front of me, and they were like, they like screamed when that scene happened, and I loved it. Like that's the stuff that you always like, you know, for as much as it's nice to be able to watch a movie at home, sometimes it's fun to be in a theater and watch movies like that because you get that communal feeling of going through like those unexpected moments with other people.
Yeah.
So,
super, super fun.
Definitely. So what is your number two?
My number two is I Am Not a Serial Killer.
Interesting. I missed that one out of South By.
Okay. Well, that's okay. It was, again, a movie that I literally knew nothing about except that Christopher Lloyd was in it. It's adapted and directed by, I believe, an Irish filmmaker named Billy O'Brien. It's based on a book, actually a series of books, which I also did not know. It's another horror movie this year that features a character, a young character who works for a parent who is a mortician or a mortician, right?
I didn't see it.
No, Autopsy of Jane Doe, right? That's what that's what that
yeah.
job title is, mortician.
Yes.
Okay. So Max Records is a kid who works for his mom, who is like the town mortician. So we have multiple horror movies this year. It's just, it's a movie, again, not knowing anything about it, really opened me up to be surprised. I think Christopher Lloyd is really terrific in it. I think, and he's gotten a lot of the press for it, but I think Max Records, who, if you're not familiar with, he was the little kid in Where the Wild Things Are.
Oh, nice.
He is amazing in this movie, playing a kid who kind of knows that he's a sociopath and is trying to resist those tendencies and kind of trying to blend in as a human being when he knows that he almost isn't one. And there's just so much of the movie that's about, what does that mean? You know, being a human, what does that mean? And it's shot on 16mm. It's one of my favorite looking movies of the year. I just love the photography of it. It has kind of a 70s feel without kind of playing that game of, look at how 70s this is. Look at the fake scratches I put in. You know, it's not just trafficking in the aesthetics of a bygone era for its own era, for its own purposes. It's just part of the aesthetic of the movie and just says some really beautiful things. I recognize there are a few moments that people may have some problems with. That's okay. It really just hit me really hard. And I think it's a really impressive, again, I think, nope, not debut. I was going to say debut, but actually this filmmaker has several other movies, none of which I've seen. But it is available on Netflix Instant if you are interested in catching up with it.
Yeah, I recently added it to my queue because, okay, like I said, I missed it on Austin. Yeah. We had somebody else cover it. So I was bummed because I actually missed out on talking to Christopher Lloyd for it. So I was very bummed. Sometimes at the festivals, you have to make choices that you just break your heart. But I think I had to cover I think it was Don't Breathe at the same time.
I was going
to
say you probably saw something that you, you know,
it wasn't the scene,
also
it was
loved.
The
so,
well, right. it was the interviews that overlapped.
Okay.
So I had to make a choice then between my screenings. So,
right,
you know, you do what you got to do. But no, that's one that's been on my radar.
This
since
is
March.
The life of a top critic.
Ugh,
this
yeah.
is what happens when you're a top
critic. So glamorous.
But definitely check it out. Hopefully you like it. All right. Which brings us to number one, the big cheese.
The big cheese. It's the moment we've all been waiting for.
What was your favorite horror movie of 2016?
31. No, I'm just joking. Could you imagine? No, and here's the thing, and I want to say this about 31, and I haven't, you know, it's just one of those things. 31 is the first review that I've ever written where I had to go back and write an addendum because
oh, really?
I felt so strongly, because there are things that were in that movie when I saw it at Sundance that were removed for the theatrical and VOD release, and I don't even think it's on the Blu-ray, that I felt like it really cheapened that movie a lot. And I remember sitting through it the second time because I paid to go see it at the special screening in September or whatever the hell it was.
Thing.
Yeah. And about 20 minutes into that movie, I realized I'd already didn't see a scene that I remembered. And I was like, huh. And then I just kept noticing little discrepancies between the version I saw and the version I was seeing. And I think had I seen only the Fathom event, like the actual release version,
yeah,
my review would have been much different.
That's interesting.
Because, what really sucks is one of the things that I talked about in my review is the fact that what I loved about it was the fact that Rob took the time with the characters this time around, and that we actually got a little more of them within the environment and stuff like that. And a lot of that stuff is gone.
Based on the version I saw, I would say it's gone. Yeah.
Like even the way that they cut it, like for example, and I'm not giving too much away, but like there's a scene where a woman's chained up to a mattress. That could be any scene in a Rob Zombie movie.
That's his romantic comedy.
But they're trying to like coerce information out of her. They don't know if they can trust her or whatever. And that scene in the original cut is way longer because it actually explains certain things about that, because all of a sudden, 10 minutes later into the movie, suddenly certain characters know how to leave. But yet you right. never actually see her tell them because it's gone.
Got it.
And so there's a lot of inconsistencies there. The California Dreamin' moment, which everybody always bags on Rob for using like these sort of 70s songs. I kind of loved it because it was sort of one of those really quiet moments in a movie that didn't have very abrasive characters, where you're just watching Sherry, Jeff, and Meg sit there and just be human beings. Like it wasn't Sherry the way Sherry's character was at the gas station.
Right, right, right.
Like they're just feeling really beat up, they're very human in that moment. And that scene was a lot longer at Sundance. And it really endeared me to those characters. And then to see it cut down like by half, you know, when they released it, you know, in theaters, like, yeah, it really bummed me out, because I know there's, I mean, I'm not saying there's an amazing version of that movie out there, but I know there's a better version. And so for me, that really bummed me out.
Yeah, that's
and
too bad. So, that sounds like
and now a... we didn't even talk about my number one movie, but just saying in that there's a better version of that movie out there.
Your number one is the Sundance cut of 31.
Exactly, is okay, what I'm good. Getting to. Yes. No, my number one, and which is funny because you sort of mentioned that you didn't think it was quite horror. But the director has come out, and it's actually, when I talked to him in the interview, he mentioned it. But he has firmly said it is horror, so I'm going to go with that. And my number one is Green Room.
Yeah, listen, I will not argue with anyone who says it's horror, honestly.
Don't argue with me, Patrick.
No, I'm not.
Don't do it.
I'm not at all. And I'm not saying, like, I didn't put it on my list because it's not horror, because I absolutely could have put it on this list. I just chose to put it on the other one. But it absolutely is a horror movie. It's a siege movie. The violence is completely out of a horror movie. Everything about it, it makes you feel the way great horror movies do. So you will get no arguments from me.
Gotcha. Yeah, That was one that I did get to see a few times. Actually, it's funny. When I saw it for the third time, it was this time I was seeing Don't Breathe for the third time. So it's funny how they sort of both overlapped at the drive-in. I go to the drive-in to rewatch movies a lot because it's cheap. And I, you know, I live the life of a writer. So, you know.
A top critic.
Top critics. You know, we can afford $3.50 per movie. Thank you very much. But no, it was one of those, I'm like, Green Room at the drive-in kind of sounds badass. And what was really cool for me is like watching, like, there's like a bunch of cars there that were there for Don't Breathe. And usually when you have like the second movie, and it was a weeknight too. So usually like when a second movie happens at the drive-in, you'll see a lot of cars leave.
Yeah.
Cause it's not the new movie. And what was really great is people stuck around for Green Room. And the only time a car left, other than when the movie was over, was one car left after the arm scene.
Well, yeah.
And I was like, well, that's okay. I can understand that. If that is your like bar that you hit, that you're like, I'm out, I would understand that. Because it's a really intense, horribly grotesque moment. And I get it. And it's not for everybody. And it was like, it blew my mind. It was like on a Wednesday night, you know. And yeah, usually when we go to the drive-in on the weeknights, like by the second movie, it's usually us and like three cars. And it was like, there was probably like 50 cars in the lot that night. And so I thought that was kind of cool, because it's this little indie movie playing with a big studio movie at the drive-in, and people stuck around for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just, and again, it's also sort of a hard movie to talk about, because and it sounds so stupid to say this, because, you know, the internet says we're not supposed to get emotionally attached to actors and actresses, but I still have trouble dealing with the fact that Anton Yelchin is dead.
Yeah.
Because I talked to him for this movie like months before.
Yeah.
And to see him give two of his best career performance, career-wise, like to do two of his best performances that we've seen from him, like to come out of this year, because I loved him in Star Trek Beyond, a movie that I feel like so many people should be talking about a lot more than they did. And I rewatched it again over Christmas, and I loved it. It's so much fun.
Me too.
I had a big goofy grin on my face the whole time. And the way that they made Chekhov just as integral, when on other movies it wasn't the case, it breaks my heart now, because they're going to have to come back to this universe. And I know they're not going to recast the character. They've already said that. But just to know that they're going to have to basically step aside from that character because of this horrible accident, like, it's awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm somebody who comes from the camp of defending the Fright Night remake. And we've had this discussion, but he was one of the reasons. I really liked him as Charlie. And I thought he brought a lot of depth to that character. Not to say that, like, William Ragsdale didn't do that in the 80s. It's just different performances for different eras. Do you know what I mean? And very different movies, too.
Yes.
He's
an actor that I absolutely took for granted, I think, because he would show up and stuff, and I would like him, and I would be like, yeah, he was pleasant. He was one of the good things about that. He did this movie a couple years ago that William H. Macy directed called Rudderless, where he's in a band with Billy Crudup, and that to me was like after he passed away, that was the movie that I wanted to go back to, but I knew I couldn't because I think it would have been, it just would have made me too sad because he's so much kind of the heart of that movie. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. If you're a fan of him, it's not a great movie, but he's great. And
yeah,
so I always liked
mine. Is, I was gonna say mine has been Alpha Dog.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Because I DVR'd it like last January, actually. And I was like, oh, I want to go back and watch that again because I really liked it. And I think it's sort of an underappreciated movie. And now within the context of losing him and like watching what happens, yeah. I'm literally trying to not cry right now, which is stupid because it's like, oh, he's an actor, you know. But the thing is like when you do this job, you know, you get very little time usually with anybody of a celebrity level. And what was really cool about with Fright Night, you know, specifically was the fact that over the course of them making that movie to them promoting that movie at different events to then the movie getting released, I had the opportunity to basically see him on 5 different occasions over the course of like a year and a half. And to the point where when I showed up for the green room interviews, he actually remembered me.
Wow.
And like, who, like, you know, I mean, I'm like a librarian, you know what I mean? Like,
you're a top critic.
Yeah, but I'm not, it's, you don't look at me and you're like, oh, I'm going to totally remember that chick's face forever. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not even going to get into that, like, oh, debate over looks or whatever, but it just, I wasn't expecting that. And it's one of these things, like, I remember when I did that junket and I was leaving. And usually you get 4 minutes, like you're in and out. It's such a ridiculous amount of time to try to talk to people. And I had to interview Anton and Jeremy for the movie. And I was making a joke with them, like on the last question. And they gave me like the wrap up signal. And then we kind of went over because I'm like, I made a joke and Anton responded and then I responded to him. So as I was leaving, one of the guys running the junket like comes up to me, and I've seen him like at a lot of different junkets because he's always running the production stuff. And he was like, tisk, tisk. And I was like, excuse me? And he was like, you know, that's not allowed. He's like, when we give you that signal, it's time to wrap up. And I, honest to God, like I felt like I was sort of being chastised by like a teacher because I'm like, I'm somebody who kind of like follows the rules. Like right, I know if somebody tells me I have 15 minutes for an interview, I know at 14 minutes, I'm wrapping this shit up. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't do that kind of stuff. But I'm so, and I kind of left there like with my tail between my legs. I was really bummed because I felt like I'd like done something wrong. And now within the context of whatever, what happened last year, like, I'm so glad I did.
Yeah.
Because it was like this really fun moment. We didn't, it wasn't in the interview that we ran on Daily Dead or anything because we cut it off because it didn't really fit like the interview style. It was just like us like quipping back and forth and being like jokey with each other. And I'm so glad I did because like this amazing talent's gone now. And so now watching Green Room with him gone, you know, it's profoundly sad that we lost him as a human being. Because there's so much that he brought to that role in an entire like story filled with just really, you know, again, the word abrasive comes to mind, but there's a lot of icky characters in that movie. And yet you're just so emotionally connected to him because he's that guy. He's us.
Right.
And, you know, he's reacting to the situation probably the way we would react to the situation.
Right.
And the way that Jeremy just keeps it all so balanced in realism, and the fact that he does it from both sides, you know, I just, that movie, I could probably watch that movie 10 times over, but it's like now it has this note of sadness.
Yeah.
But I loved it, and I loved Imogen Poots in it. Speaking of Fright Night, like I thought she was very miscast in that movie, but I thought, you know, Green Room, she's one of the best things about that movie, and it's such a subtle performance.
Yeah.
You know, and I you know, for everything for me, that movie just clicked so perfectly. And it's, again, it's one of those movies, like, I don't go and recommend a lot of horror movies to friends who don't like horror movies. But, like, I know people who are, like, sort of into thrillers. I'm like, you really need to watch Green Room because it will rip you apart. And it does.
It's incredibly well made. And again, Jeremy Saulnier is one of those guys who, after Blue Ruin, I would have said, like, oh, that's a guy, I'll watch anything he makes. And then Green Room comes along, and you're like, well, fucking A, right. I'm glad I made that promise to myself. Because I think it's, I won't even say it's even better, but it's certainly a little bit bigger in terms of the scope. And I had commented last week, I think, when I was talking about the movie, on my other top 10 list, that one of the things that I liked about it is how true to all of the characters it is, that everyone is an established human being who kind of, the movie gives them the space to be people, but also follows through on the ways that they would react to things. So it's not just Anton Yelchin kind of reacting to things the way that we might, but it's also, what's his name from Blue Ruin, whose name I'm
blank. Macon Blair.
Thank you, Macon Blair. The way that he reacts when shit starts to go bad, or Imogen Poots, you know, a lesser movie, I think, would have sold out her character in those last few minutes.
Yeah.
And this movie doesn't. It allows her to be that person all the way up to the end credits. And I so admire that. I think it's the most tense movie of the year. I think it's just a tremendous movie. So I fully support its placement as your number one.
Wonderful.
You already know my number one.
Now I can sleep in it.
Yes, thank God.
What was your number one again?
You already know my number one, right?
I don't know. Do I?
It's okay if you don't.
Of course.
So when we did our list.
And again, I could have, if we would have had a 15, that might have made my number 15. And that's not to say anything about the movie. It's just, holy shit. I mean, we could have done a top 30 maybe.
Yeah, right. Well, right. So when we did our list of Daily Dead, nothing on my list was ranked, except I made it a point to single this movie out as being my favorite. And that is Beyond the Gates, another first-time filmmaker, Jackson Stewart, co-wrote and directed. Last week at F This Movie, we were running our top 10 lists, and one of our writers, Eric Asperschlager, who's always very wise, wrote something when he was talking about his number one movie. He said, you know, we don't choose our favorite movies. They choose us. And that's very true. And that's exactly how I feel about Beyond the Gates. I saw it at the Bruce Campbell Fest and I didn't know much about it. I kind of knew it was about, you know, this haunted VHS board game.
For the record, do you remember that? Like, I think I texted you after it and I said you were going to love this.
Yes, I was right. Well, that's the thing. So, and I knew that, like, oh, it's kind of an 80s throwback, you know, and I knew there was some Fulci influence just based on the title. So there were things about it that, of all the movies that I knew I was going to see at that festival, that's the one that I was most looking forward to. And it was kind of that rare case of, it was the movie that delivered on exactly what I wanted it to be, you know, because sometimes when you're that excited about a movie, it's going to let you down. But this was like, oh, this is exactly what I wanted it to be. And it does. It feels like a movie that just chose me. I had written a piece that ran on Daily Dead about the last few months of this year being shitty and feeling terrible all the time because of so much of what's happening in the world. And that the movie that I keep turning to like feel better is Beyond the Gates, because as opposed to certain other horror movies, which by design exist to tear us down and shake us and leave us unsettled and upset, right? That is the purpose of horror films, essentially. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? Just sends us out of the theater, not trusting anything and being just terrified of everything. Beyond the Gates kind of works in the opposite direction, which is like it kind of starts and things feel shitty. And by the end, two characters hug and it's like the most sincere and heartfelt moment in a movie I saw this year. And it's so earned based on what had happened before it. You know, we talked in terms of Mike Flanagan movies, like when you care about the characters, it makes it so much easier to buy into the premise of a horror movie or some of the more outrageous supernatural stuff. And that's absolutely true. There weren't any characters I bought into more than the characters in Beyond the Gates this year. And yes, aesthetically, it pushes certain buttons of mine, right? Because I like Fulci and I like 80s movies and I like that super pink light and the blue light and the VHS stuff. All that stuff, you know, pushes my buttons. But it wasn't, again, one of these nonstop nostalgia fests, right? Where it's just like, remember things you used to like? Here they are. I'll bet you'll like this. It wasn't trying to. I watched a movie a couple weeks ago on VOD, and I won't name it because that's not fair to the filmmakers, but it went out of its way to have a retro feel And sometimes I feel like when filmmakers do that, they feel like it gives them license to make a shitty movie. They're like, well, see, we're trying to make a movie that feels like a shitty movie from 1981. It's like, well, there's a reason I don't rewatch the shitty movie from 1981 over and over again, right? Because it's shitty. I rewatch the good movie from 1981. So there are certain filmmakers who will just lean on an aesthetic as an as a reason for being, and Beyond the Gates never does that. You know, the aesthetic informs some of the film, but I think there's so much more to the movie in terms of the characters, in terms of what it has to say about, again, grief and loss and healing. And it's also just a shit ton of fun. You know, heads are exploding and intestines are flying out of bodies. And
Barbara Crampton's looking at you like Barbara Crampton wants to possess your soul.
Stares in silence and gets such this huge laugh. And the way that she says "Beyond the Gates" over and over again, the more times she says it, the more she kind of draws it out. So by the end, she's just "Beyond the Gates." It's so much fun. I really, really love this movie.
Yeah, no, it is an immense amount of fun. And like, again, I think that talks to or sort of speaks to the fact that, you know, all of these people involved with this movie were already, I believe, mostly friends. Like, you know, obviously there's the horror community out here in Los Angeles, and they're all very tight. You know, everybody out here, you know, in certain circles are very supportive of each other, and you can tell that everybody in that movie was in it for the right reasons. Yeah. And they all wanted to be there and they all wanted to be part of this. And I think, you know, for Jackson to come out swinging the way that he did with his, you know, first feature film, I mean, it's really remarkable. And again, the fact that so many really great first time films came out, you know, first time movies, you know, from these like up and coming directors came out in 1 year. It's unprecedented. I would love to, you know, I love numbers. I love number crunching. I don't have time to do it. But I'd love to like see sort of, you know, which, you know, first time directors we get from like the last 5 years, and just to compare, because I think 2016 might be kind of like a record.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a great year for first time filmmakers. And again, obviously I'm excited to see whatever Jackson does next. And if he never made another movie, which obviously I hope is not true, but if he never made another movie, I will always have, this is a movie that's always going to be special to me. And that's a rare feeling. Even in past years when we've done this show, I've had, you know, my number one choice, and it's like, oh man, I love this movie and it does so many things right, but it doesn't connect with me emotionally as strongly as this one did. And so I'm just really excited.
It's kind of like it's like you're What We Do in the Shadows.
Perhaps it may be. So there's our list. Was there anything else? We mentioned all of my honorable mentions, which were Conjuring 2, Jane Doe, The Wailing, Train to Busan, Hush, Ouija, Origin of Evil. The only one we didn't mention that I would put in my honorable mentions is The Mind's Eye, the Joe Bigas movie. And again, some of that is like, I like the aesthetics of it. That is a movie that is kind of about the aesthetics and kind of about being a throwback. But it's a really fun throwback, and it's one of those movies that I enjoy just based on almost who's in it, because there's Graham Skipper and Lauren Ashley Carter having sex, and there's Matt Mercer showing up, and there's Larry Fessenden, of course, dying, and there's Jeremy Gardner playing a bad guy. Like,
if there was indie horror bingo, it would win.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
You could win four ways with that movie. Right. No, and I like Mind's Eye, and I think Joe's a really, really great filmmaker.
It's fun. I mean, that's, yeah. You know, it's not, like I said, it's not an all-timer, but I think it's fun.
No, definitely. Yeah, I mean, seriously, I could have done an entirely, like, separate, like, top 10 list. Because, I mean, I didn't even talk about, like, some of the movies that showed up on my favorites. Because, like, Under the Shadow for me was a really big one.
Yeah.
I didn't even talk about Carnage Park.
Right.
Either, which I really loved. And again, speaks to sort of, you know, Mickey doing his thing, you know, sort of riffing on other films. But I just thought he did a really hell of a great job with it. I even really liked Road Games, speaking of Barbara Crampton. I thought Abner Pastol did a really fantastic job with that movie. And again, making something so very unexpected.
Yeah.
You know, and also The Monster, which is another one that I really wasn't expecting much from.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know if it's because I haven't spoken to my mom now in like 4 years, but you know, it was one of those movies where it just, it hit me like out of, like right out of nowhere, in ways I wasn't expecting. And I think Zoe Kazan gives an amazing performance in that movie. And, you know, cringeworthy scenes, like I feel like the garage scene that she shares with her daughter is just one of the most, like, oh God, you know, it's a brutal scene in a very different way than you get in a lot of horror movies.
Well, and it's what we were talking about with Don't Breathe, where I think there's a way to achieve some of that same stuff in a way that feels more honest. And the monster to me felt more honest and less like it was trafficking in movie stereotypes.
Yeah.
I thought her performance was great. I thought the emotional stuff in the movie was great. The horror stuff didn't work quite as well for me, even though I liked a lot of it. I liked that movie a lot. And again, I like that, you know, we have the Babadook, we have Under the Shadow, we have the monster. And what those movies all have in common, besides kind of parent-child relationships, is that they're all talking about something beyond just, hey, there's this scary thing that's trying to get us, but they're using the scary thing as a way of talking about the thing, right? And so we're having very kind of emotional stories being told through the prism of a horror film, and that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think for me, Under the Shadow probably does it best. I know you're Team Babadook. But I think for me, just Under the Shadow in terms of taking that idea, but then also setting it within this really amazingly, horrifically intense period of time.
Yeah, that was
literally you don't know if death is coming at you. Right. So you've got it coming from both ways. Like, I'm a wuss. I don't know what the hell I would do, but, you know.
Yeah, Babadook for me is much more kind of parent-child, and Under the Shadow is much more political, which to me was super interesting. It got compared to the Babadook so much, and I'm sure I compared it more than once, but to me it's less interesting on kind of that mother-child relationship as it is in terms of that political setting, because I thought that was super interesting.
See, and I'm more Under the Shadow than the Babadook.
Yeah, no, I think they're both really cool in different ways, you know.
Yeah, but it was again, it's like one of those years where I'm like, I seriously could have had another 10 movies.
Yeah,
you know,
because then, like you said, there's those movies that I could talk about that I don't think work all the way, but again, I would recommend. Baskin would have been one, you know, where it was like, yeah, I like this, this, and this, and even if it didn't all come together for me. Another one is The Devil's Dolls. Did you see The Devil's Dolls?
I have not.
Okay. There's some stuff in there that's like really great and interesting, some stuff that's really fun. It has, Graham Skipper showed up in a lot of movies this year. This is more of a cameo, but it's like one of the best cameos in a horror movie this year. And especially if you are a fan of indie horror or a fan of him, because you expect one thing and it gives you something else. It didn't all work for me, but there was enough in it where it's a movie that I would recommend to other horror fans, you know. So that doesn't even make the next in list. But if there's a next in to the next in, that's on it, you know. So there's a lot of cool stuff this year.
Yeah. And again, what I didn't even mention, like, you know, I sort of swapped it out at the last minute. But Eyes of My Mother, which I don't think you liked nearly as much as I did.
For me, it was like this year's Goodnight Mommy, which is to say super well made, didn't do much for me.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know about you, Bromley. I saw it in July. It's, again, one of those movies that I think of every day. But for me, I also had to kind of go back and look at the rewatch. And it's a tough movie to rewatch, because I feel like that journey is so, so heartbreakingly conflicting at points, because you just, like, there's moments where, like, my heart aches for this woman, but yet she's doing these horrible things.
Right, right.
And it pulls you in ways that you don't really know how to feel about yourself.
Well, because you almost feel like she can't help it. Like, it's not her fault. I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of those, like, again, I kind of swapped out last minute because it very well for me easily could have been a top 10 movie.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's, God, it was such a rough year to have to pick. But I love the fact that, like, between our two lists, I think we only had two overlaps.
That's amazing.
Wow.
And that every movie on the other person's list, you know, I know you didn't have a chance to see everything that I named, but every movie we're like, yeah, we had good things to say about it. It was never like, what? You're fucking nuts, you know, to put this on your list. Not that we've ever really had that conversation about top tens, at least. There are certainly movies that one of us likes that the other one's like, what?
Yeah.
Howling too. But listen, it was
one day you're going to be on your deathbed one day before Emil Hirsch comes to do your autopsy.
Yes.
And you're going to be like, Heather was right about Howling too. And
I'll tell you what, I may not be thinking like Heather was right, but I will be thinking about the end credits of Howling too. And so in that way, you've won.
I know. And that's really, honestly, I mean, how else would you really want to go out?
Thinking about the end credits may be the thing that gives me the heart attack that kills me. Who could say for sure?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, and I also want to point this out too. We're discussing a year of horror where there was a horror movie with Keanu Reeves and it didn't even make my top 10.
Oh, that was on my other, that was the other movie that I couldn't think of. That was in my regular top 10, but yeah, Neon Demon was like number 10 on my other list.
Oh, okay.
I know you didn't like it as much as me, but
I was so primed for that movie. Like, yeah. That movie, like, it's like reading my diary or something. Like, I don't know. Like, and I was just right. I mean, again, it could have just been a weird night or something. And I have the Blu-ray, so I do want to revisit it, even though I know it's on Amazon Prime. But yeah, I was so hopeful for that. And it just did not connect for me. And yeah. Man, I'm still disappointed. That's why, again, I want to give it a chance again, because right. I was so disappointed by my reaction where I'm like, you crazy girl. Like,
that was kind of how I felt with 31, where I was like, I wanted to like this and I don't. And so I watched it again. And I was like, I still don't really like this.
I will say, I think 31 is kind of zombies' least like rewatch value movie. I mean, I've grown to appreciate his Halloween movies over the last few years. I'm not calling them great or anything,
sure,
but
I've
come to appreciate the fact that there are redeeming things about both of them, actually.
Yes.
But, you know, to me, I think the rewatch value, like, was lost after, like, Devil's Rejects. Because I still go back to House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects regularly throughout the year.
Oh, I could rewatch almost his Halloween, which I'm a bigger fan of than you. I don't rewatch much, only because, like, why wouldn't I just watch the Carpenter one?
Yeah.
Because the second half is so similar that it's like, I'm not going to get enough of a different experience. And so if I'm looking for that experience, I'll just watch Carpenter's. His Halloween 2, I do rewatch pretty often, though, because I do think it's a different movie. And I really like Lords of Salem, so I rewatch that one as well.
Damn it, I forget about Lords of Salem. I've actually watched that, like, a few times.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of his recent that I rewatched. I've watched about 4 or 5 times. It was on cable a bunch over the summer.
Nice.
So I'd throw it on when I was working and stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, what a damn good year.
Yes, it has been
in
a great year.
In terms of horror.
Right. Well, right. Yeah, not in terms of... If you're a Cubs fan or a horror fan, you had a great year.
2016 was it. And if you were a Cubs fan who loved horror, like, you peaked. You might as well give up.
You might
There's nothing else.
Put on the end credits of Howling 2 now and just...
Wait for Emil Hirsch to show up.
Wait for Emil Hirsch. This is the callback part of the podcast. We are running super long, so I will wrap it up. But I always enjoy doing this show with you so much. It's so fun to talk about horror movies that we love and are excited about. And hopefully we're turning people on to some movies that they might have missed. So thank you very much for doing this show.
You're very welcome. And also, because I don't put anything on my list that hasn't officially come out this year, two movies that I want to say people should definitely watch out for this year is The Girl with All the Gifts.
Yes.
And Raw.
I'm looking forward to both of those.
Yes. Raw, probably, depending on how this year goes, could probably end up in a top 3 spot for me.
Woo.
It's that damn good.
The two that I would tell people to look for are The Black Coat's Daughter.
I haven't seen it. I'm really excited.
It just got, I think, finally a date. But that will be on my top 10 list for sure. And if it gets distribution this year, I don't know that it will. Found Footage 3D is really, really, really fun.
Another one I'm very much looking forward to. Yeah, I hope they get it. It seems like they've had a lot of good buzz on the festivals, at the festivals they played. So fingers crossed.
Yeah.
I'm excited. I want to see it.
I wonder how much of the, if there is a sticking point, I wonder if it's, because I think it's a movie that should be seen in 3D, and I never say that. And the way that indie horror is now, everything just goes to VOD. And so that 3D aspect will be lost. And so maybe they are kind of holding out for a theatrical 3D run, which I think they should. I think that's how people should see it. But obviously that's an uphill battle, you know?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, what do? Lock the 3D off and just release it as found footage?
Like, right, right.
Then people aren't going to know what to make of it. Like, I think when you say found footage 3D, if you're intelligent enough to understand what they're doing there, you get it.
Right.
You know what you're in for.
Right.
But no, I really want to see it. I missed it at Screamfest, so I'm hoping to catch it one of these days. So hopefully it gets nabbed.
Both of those are really strong. So that's exciting to know we have at least 4 good horror movies coming out. Hopefully this year. Heather, where can people find more of your stuff online?
I am over at dailydead.com and thehorrorchick.com, I guess, also. Sometimes I post some little fun tidbits there, but then over on Twitter, I'm at thehorrorchick, and if you would like to follow along with the fun things we're doing with the book account, that is Monster Squad FX.
Awesome. Thank you guys very much for listening. As always, we're at fthismovie.net and we're on Twitter at fthismovie or on iTunes or wherever you find podcasts. Thank you guys very much for listening to this epic show. Heather, have a great time at Sundance.
Thank you. And based on our schedule, we'll probably talk again, like, what, July?
Let's not push it. Let's just hold
August,
off till October.
September.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you'll be in town maybe in August.
This October. Yeah. I was going to say, you couldn't even squeeze me in this October. Who knows if you're going to be able to make room for me or last October. So,
shoot,
you know.
Good point.
Yeah. It's all right. I only cried like a little bit on Halloween when I realized Patrick had left me on a scary movie month. But, you know, I persevered.
You are always welcome anytime. thank you guys very much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.